DH Audio presents Thursdays at 8. Written by Debbie Maycomer. Read for you by Paula Parker. Abridged by Suzanne Ritchie. From the diary of Claire Craig. January 1st. This year is a new beginning for me. A fresh start. In more ways than one. I'm determined to put the divorce behind me. About time, too, since it's been final for over a year. Okay, 13 months and 6 days to be exact, though I'm not counting. Well, maybe I am. But that's going to stop as of today. It's been a struggle to let go of the marriage. But holding on to all that pain and anger is getting me nowhere. I'm sick of the pettiness, sick of fighting, and sick to death of the resentment, the bitterness. I just never thought anything like this could possibly happen to Michael and me. I can only imagine what Carl would think if he were alive. It's all so crazy. Our top car salesman keels over from a heart attack, and Michael, being a caring friend and business owner, helps the grieving widow with the funeral arrangements and the insurance paperwork. Even crazier is the fact that I actually suggested it. My one concern at the time was that Michael might be getting too close to the widow. Only, it wasn't Kathy keeping my husband entertained all those nights. It was her 20-year-old daughter, Miranda. I don't think Kathy or I will ever get over the shock of it. My mistake, and I made a few, was in delaying the divorce as long as I did. Eternal optimist that I am, I clung to the belief that, given time, Michael would come to his senses. I was convinced that eventually he'd see how much he was hurting me and the boys. An affair with a 20-year-old was sheer madness. Surely he'd wake up one morning and realize he'd destroyed his entire life. And for what? Good sex? I doubt she's that incredible in the sack. But if there's anything to smile about regarding this ugly divorce, it's the misery Lillian Case, my attorney, put Michael through. Michael repeatedly claimed he wanted a friendly divorce. But as Lillian said, it was far too late for that. It's going to take Michael 20 long years to pay off my share of the dealership, plus interest. I have the house, a new car every year, health insurance, the boys' college expenses, and enough money to live comfortably. I only have to work if I want to. The boys still aren't speaking to him. I'm not sure Mick ever will. Alex was always close to his father, and I know he misses Michael. I've done my best to stay out of it. Nothing will ever change the fact that he's their father. How they choose to deal with him is up to them. I refuse to encourage either boy to forgive and forget, but I won't hold them back from a relationship with Michael either. The choice is theirs. 23 years of marriage and I never looked at another man. Damn it all, I was a faithful, loving wife. I could have tolerated an affair if he'd given it up and returned to our marriage. But no, he... Okay, enough. I don't need to keep repeating the same gory details. As I said, this is a fresh start. The first day of a new year. I'm giving myself permission to move on, as my psychobabbling counselor used to put it. Part of moving on is belonging to the breakfast group with my new friends, Liz, Julia, and Karen. I met these women in my journal writing class, and forming these new relationships is one of the positive changes I've made. That and continuing to write in my journal. I'm glad the four of us have decided to continue seeing each other, even though the class isn't being offered again. Thursdays for breakfast was an inspired idea. Liz suggested we each pick a word for the year before we meet next Thursday morning at Mocha Moments. A word... I haven't quite figured out which word would best suit me. I've toyed with the idea of beginnings, as in new beginnings, but I don't want to carry that theme around with me for the next 12 months. At some point, beginnings have to become middles and potential has to be realized. I guess I'm afraid I won't be as successful as I want to be. What I really need to do is discover who I am now that I'm single again. For 23 years, my identity was linked to Michael. We were a team, complementing each other's strengths and weaknesses. I was always better with finances, and Michael was the people person. He took a part-time job selling cars the first year we were married in order to supplement our budget, and quickly became the top salesman. Soon he was working full-time at the Chevrolet dealership, and I was stretching every dollar he made, creating a small nest egg. Then we had the chance to buy the dealership, the opportunity of a lifetime. We scraped together every penny we could. By the time the paperwork was finished, we didn't have a cent between us, but we were happy. I can't write about that. Don't want to dwell on how happy we were in those early years. Whenever I think about it, I feel overwhelmed by the pain of loss and regret. So much regret. Word. I need a word. Not memories. I can't tie my new identity to the past and to who I was. I've got to look toward the future. So I need a word that fits who I am today. The woman I'm becoming. The woman I want to be. Just a minute here. Just a damn minute. Who I was? Who I want to be? Why do I have to change? There's nothing wrong with me. I wasn't the one who ripped the heart out of this family. I was a good wife, a good mother. I was faithful. Faithful. That's it. My word. From the moment I spoke my vows, I was faithful to my husband, my marriage, my family. All these years, I've been faithful to myself. I've never acted dishonestly. And I've always put my family responsibilities above my own desires. I don't need to find myself. I found out who I am a long time ago. And frankly, I happen to like that person. I wasn't the one who changed. Michael did. This feels good. The burden isn't on my shoulders to prove one damn thing. I'll remain faithful to me. Happy New Year, Claire Craig. You're going to have a wonderful year. Mom, can we talk? Claire Craig glanced up from her desk to find Alex, her 17-year-old son, standing in the doorway of the family room. The holiday break was already over. School had begun earlier in the week. Mick had left that morning for college in San Francisco. Claire gave her younger son her full attention. What can I do for you? He hesitated, then spoke. Mick and I had a long talk last night. Claire had surmised as much. She heard them in Alex's bedroom sometime after midnight, deep in conversation. He's upset with me. Mick is? What for? Alex shrugged and looked away. If you and your brother had a falling out, why didn't you just tell me instead of expecting me to guess? He raised his head and their eyes met briefly. Because I'm afraid you're going to react the same way Mick did. Oh? And how's that? He shrugged and looked away again. Claire recognized a delaying tactic when she saw one. Alex? He took a deep breath and squared his shoulders. All right, he said brusquely. I've been talking to Dad. Claire swallowed hard. But a small, shocked sound still managed to escape. She felt as though she'd taken a punch to the solar plexus. Alex watched her anxiously. Are you mad? I don't want you to feel like I've betrayed you, too. That's what Mick said I was doing. First Dad, and now me. Mom, I swear to you, it isn't like that. He is your father, Claire said, to remind herself as much as her son. You two should be communicating. You don't mind? His obvious relief was painful to hear. She swallowed tightly. Alex, you're my son, but you're also your father's. I can't forgive him for what he did. I know, Claire whispered, wishing she could hide the trembling in her voice. Her son glanced at his watch and did a startled double-take. I'm late for soccer practice. She waved toward the door. Go on, then. Dad said he might start coming to my games. Alex said. The words rushed as he hurried to the door. Alex? Sorry, Mom, gotta go. Oh, great. Now she had to worry about running into her ex at their son's soccer games. Almost immediately the resentment sprang up as strong as the day Michael had left her. He'd already taken so much, How dared he steal the pleasure she derived from watching Alex play soccer? How dared he? Once again, her ex-husband had gone behind her back. From the diary of Liz Kenyon, January 1st. For the first time in my 57 years, I spent New Year's Eve alone. I ordered in Chinese and ate my chicken hot sauce noodles in front of the television. Then at midnight, I brought in the New Year's sipping champagne all by myself. I was in bed a few minutes after 12, my thoughts full of Steve. After 6 years, the memories aren't as painful as they were in the beginning. What continues to haunt me are the last minutes of my husband's life. I wonder what went through his mind when he realized the huge semi had crossed the yellow line and was headed straight toward him. I wonder obsessively if his last thoughts were of the children or me, or if in those split seconds there'd been time to feel anything but panic and fear. As I lay in bed, I remembered our last morning together, as clearly as if it had happened yesterday, instead of 6 years ago. April 20th was an ordinary day, like so many others. We both got up and dressed for work. While I made breakfast, Steve shaved. We sat across from one another at the kitchen table and chatted about the morning news. Then he kissed me goodbye as I left for the hospital. An hour later, my high school sweetheart and husband of 31 years was dead. My life hasn't been the same since. It'll never be the same again. I'm still trying to accept the fact that Steve won't come bursting through the front door wearing his sexy grin. Even now, I sleep on the far right side of the bed. Steve's half remains undisturbed. The last 3 months have been hard. I knew when Amy phoned to tell me Jack had been transferred to Tulsa that being separated from my daughter and grandchildren was going to be difficult. What I didn't realize was how difficult. And then, as if my daughter and her family moving to another state wasn't bad enough, Brian had to go and move out on his own. My son always did display impeccable timing. He got a great job offer, though, and I don't begrudge his taking it for a minute. I just wish it hadn't happened quite so soon. I'm not entirely alone. My friends are here, those I've known all my married life. And my new friends, too. The women I met in the journal writing class. I'm glad I enrolled. It was exactly what I needed, and I've learned a great deal about myself through the process of writing down my thoughts every day. Spending New Year's Eve alone was my choice. Sean Jameson casually suggested we get together for dinner. I'm not going to make the mistake of getting involved with a man who has a reputation as a womanizer, although I readily admit his interest flatters my ego. Besides, I'm older than he is. Not by much. 6 years, maybe seven. Just enough to make me a little uncomfortable. Not that I'd seriously consider dating him anyway. My major complaint, in addition to the age difference, is that he's the exact opposite of Steve, who was genuine and unassuming. The good doctor is stuck on himself. Still, he's obviously an interesting man. I wouldn't mind talking to him on a strictly friends basis. Nothing romantic or sexual. Just conversation, maybe over coffee or a drink. After all, everyone can use another friend. Speaking of friends, when Claire, Julia, and Karen and I met after our last journal writing class, we decided to continue the friendship by meeting for breakfast every Thursday at 8 o'clock. I came up with a suggestion that we should each take a word for the year, a word to live by, to help us focus our thoughts, a word to reflect what's happening in our lives and what we want to do and be. Karen loved the idea, but then Karen's young and enthusiastic about everything. That's what makes her so much fun and why I enjoy her so much. And I enjoy Julia, too, but it's Claire I identify with most. We've been spending quite a bit of time together. That's probably natural, her being recently divorced and me a widow. The loneliness is something we both understand. It took a while, but I found a word that feels right for me. Time. I'm 57. In 3 years, I'll be 60. 60. I don't feel close to 60, and I don't think I act it. Still, it's the truth, whether I choose to face it or not. At one point, when we were in our 20s, Steve and I wrote a list of all the exciting things we were going to do and the exotic vacations we planned to take. The years slipped away, and we were caught up with raising our family and living our lives. Those dreams and plans got pushed into an indefinite future. We assumed there'd always be time. Someday, or next year, or the year after that. This is a mistake I don't intend to repeat, and why the word time is appropriate for me. I want to be aware of every moment of my life, and I want to choose the right plans and dreams to fulfill in the years that are still left to me. Time. This should be the best time of my life. I have a fabulous career. When I started out at Willow Grove Memorial, I never dreamed that one day I'd end up as the hospital administrator. My children have grown into responsible adults. I had a wonderful marriage, and I've got lots of memories to sustain me. Yes, this should be a good time, and it will be, once I learn how to live contentedly by myself. Liz stared at the phone on her desk, dreading its ring. Her Monday had begun badly, and already she could see that this first week of the new year was going to be a repeat of December, with many of the same problems she'd faced then. The hospital was no closer to a new contract with the nurses' union. The nurses were threatening to go on strike, and the state health inspectors were scheduled for Wednesday afternoon. This was not a good start to the year, she thought gloomily. Then she heard a deep male voice, one she immediately identified. I can see I've cornered you at a good moment. Dr. Jameson, she said in a crisp, professional tone. He was rarely at Willow Grove Memorial. Most of his patients were admitted to Laurelhurst Children's Hospital, where he worked primarily with premature infants. Sean Jameson was an excellent pediatrician, but he had a well-deserved reputation for being demanding, impatient, and arrogant. Liz couldn't fault his medical skills, but when it came to dealing with staff, he could use a few lessons in emotional maturity. Come now, he said, his voice seductive. We know each other well enough for you to call me Sean. Liz motioned for him to sit down. How can I help you? He claimed the closest chair and leaned back as if he was settling in for a long visit. This is more of a social visit. I stopped by to see how you're doing. I'm busy. He ignored her lack of welcome. How was your New Year's Eve? I had a lovely night. What about you? Stayed home, didn't you? Yes, but as I said, I had a perfectly lovely evening. All alone? I happened to enjoy my own company. Standing, she braced both hands on the edge of her cherrywood desk. I'm sorry to cut this short, but I have a meeting in 10 minutes. I'm willing to give you another chance to go out with me. No, thanks. He grinned, dismissing her rejection as though it was her loss, not his. Then he stood and turned away, ambling toward the door. Sean, she said, shocking herself just a little. His smile firmly in place, he raised his eyebrows. Change your mind? As a matter of fact, no. This is the second time you've stopped by my office to ask me out. I've turned you down both times, and I'm wondering if you've asked yourself why. It's self-explanatory, he murmured. You're afraid. It's more than that. It's your attitude. For the first time in their lengthy association, Sean appeared to be at a loss for words. Liz continued, I happen to think you're one of the finest pediatricians in this state. I respect your diagnostic and medical skills. And I've seen the way you are with the children. My regard for your professional abilities is immense. But your manner with most people in this hospital leaves a lot to be desired, and frankly, I'm not impressed. Is this the long version of why you're not interested in dating me? He barely disguised his disdain. Actually, I'd like to get to know you. You have an odd way of saying so. I suspect there's more to you than meets the eye. Great. Your place or mine? Liz wanted to groan out loud. He hadn't heard a word she'd said. Neither. She held the door for him and added soberly, When you're ready to see me as an intelligent, mature woman whose professional interests are compatible with yours, let me know. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. I doubt that. He stepped past and paused to touch his lips to her cheek. Give me a call when you're ready for some excitement in your life. Liz rolled her eyes. Some people never learned. From the diary of Karen Curtis. January 1st. I woke at noon, nursed a tall half-calf, decaf, double-sweet mocha latte for breakfast. Nicole phoned and wanted to hang out at the mall, so we did. I ran into Jeff, who's working at Body and Spirit Gym, and we talked for a while. He's wasting his life teaching Tai Bo classes to a bunch of overweight business executives who don't care about anything beyond their corporate image. I really found it hard to hold my tongue. Jeff is letting his talent go down the drain, and it upsets me. Jeff and I made a vow to one another in high school drama class that we wouldn't give up the dream. It was all I could do not to grab him by the shoulders and remind him. And Jeff isn't the only one who's given up. Angie and Bert did, too. Last I heard, Sydney and Leslie had regular 9-to-5 jobs. So did Brad. Out of the 7 of us who made up the acting ensemble, there's only me left. I refuse to surrender to the mundane. I refuse to take second best. I am an actor. Currently a starving one, but that's beside the point. All right, I'll step down from my soapbox. God forbid my biggest fear is about to become a reality. I'm beginning to sound like my mother, the woman who always knows best. Now there's a thought to send me screaming into the night. She and Dad insisted I get a college education. I disagreed, stood my ground, fought the good fight, but then during a period of below poverty level existence, I caved in. Hey, they might have won the battle, but the war's all mine. Since the day I was born, my domineering mother has attempted to run my life. From the moment I enrolled in college, she's demanded I be a teacher. A lifelong occupation, she said, a good job for a woman. Give me a break. Well, I have that precious degree in history with a minor in education, but I have no intention of using it, except where it'll aid my acting career. Fortunately, I found a way in which to do that. Oddly enough, it also means my mother's kind of getting what she wants. But that's just a byproduct. The important thing is, I'm getting what I want. You see, I'm a substitute teacher. Due to the severe teacher shortage currently happening in Southern California, anyone with a college degree can be hired as a substitute teacher. Isn't that incredible? I can have a degree in basket weaving and qualify as a teacher for a whopping $250 a day. Now, I don't mind telling you, that's good money for part-time work. What's so fantastic is this. I can pick and choose the days I want to teach. If I can fit subbing into my schedule, I spend 2 or 3 days a week in a classroom, 3 at the most. That way, I still make enough money to support myself. On the days I don't work, I can audition for whatever's available. Before the holiday break, my agent sent me out to audition for a TV commercial for a new kind of toilet brush. The district called first thing that morning, and without fear of losing my job, and without so much as a twinge of guilt, I said I had other plans. No problem. They simply went to the next name on the list. I headed out the door, knowing there'll be a job for me another day if I want it. Sadly, I didn't get the commercial. But rejection's the name of the acting game. I know I'm an embarrassment to my mother. She can't brag about me to all her society friends the way she does Victoria. My sister had the good judgment to marry an up-and-coming attorney who raised our family's social standing an entire notch. As far as I'm concerned, Roger is a twit. But no one's asking my opinion. Good thing, too, because I'm not afraid to give it. Liz, Claire, and Julia are 3 surprises that came out of me finishing my credits to get my degree. I signed up for that journal writing class because I needed an easy credit. I was convinced I'd be bored out of my mind. And then I met 3 of the most fascinating women I've ever talked to. I love these guys. And I'm thrilled we've decided to keep meeting, just the 4 of us. Me and three smart professional women. I don't know what exactly I offer the group. My guess is comic relief. They've kind of adopted me, and I'm grateful. What I like is the perspective they give me, being older and all. Liz is the sort of person I wish my mother could be. Unlike Mom, Liz has been nothing but encouraging about my acting career. I know what the chances are of actually making it. But I can't allow unfavorable odds to dissuade me from trying. This is my dream, my life's ambition. If I don't go after it now, I never will. I honestly don't understand why my mother can't support my choices. Enough already. This entire journal is turning out to be about my mother instead of me. I'd prefer not to deal with her today, or any day. Besides, Liz gave us an assignment. I need a word before we meet next Thursday. We're all selecting a personal word. It's supposed to have special significance in our lives. Maybe I should use this as an acting exercise. Do some free association. Let's see. Acting. Goal. Audition. Wouldn't it be great to audition for a TV show like Friends? Friends. New friends. Liz, Claire, and Julia. What I love about them is that they're so accepting of me. I love that they laugh at my jokes and make me feel a real part of the group. If only my mother were half as accepting. That's it. I've got it. Acceptance. I want my parents to accept me for the person I am. I might not have turned out the way they envisioned, but I am a good, decent, honest person. That should count for something. If my parents can welcome a twit like Roger into the family, they should be able to cope with a daughter who wants to act. Acceptance. I like it. My hope is that one day my mother will accept me for who I am and be just as proud of me as she is of Victoria. From the diary of Julia Murchison, January 1st. This leather-bound journal is a Christmas gift from my husband, and I've been waiting until today to make my first entry. My hope is that every morning I'll be filling the crisp, clean pages, writing out my thoughts, my concerns, my doubts, discovering who I am one day at a time. That's something I learned in the journal class, along with a whole lot more. Taking that class was one of the best things I've done for myself in ages. It's funny. Here I am waxing poetic about this lovely journal that I've been waiting all week to start. And now that I have, I don't know what to write. I'll begin with the kids, I guess. Adam and Zoe are growing up before my very eyes. It seems like only yesterday that they were babies. Now they're both in their teens. And before Peter and I know it, they'll be in college. It doesn't seem possible that Adam will be driving this year. He's champing at the bit to get behind the wheel. He's ready, but I'm not sure Peter and I are. Zoe at 13 is turning into a real beauty. I look at her, so innocent and lovely, and I can hardly believe my baby is already a young woman. The wool station is a year old now. I've always loved crafts, and opening my own small knit shop was a risky venture. I thought about it for quite a while before making the commitment. Peter's encouragement was all I really needed, and he gave it to me. The store's been wonderful for both of us, bringing us together. And business has been good. I'm not making enough of a profit to draw a salary yet, but it won't be long. A year, two at the most. I just wish I was feeling better physically. Lately, ever since the flu bug hit me before Thanksgiving, I've been under the weather. I didn't bounce back nearly as fast as I thought I would. Being thrust into the holiday season right afterward wasn't any help. The shop was crazy all through December. Added to that were the usual Christmas obligations, buying presents, wrapping them, sending cards, entertaining, etc. When I think about everything I've had to do, it's no wonder I haven't been feeling well. On to a far more pleasant subject, and that's the Thursday morning breakfast club. Liz, Claire, Karen, and I bonded like super glue, and when the session was over, Liz suggested we continue meeting. She's the one with all the good ideas. Every Thursday at 8. What a treat. We're supposed to choose a word for the year. My mind was made up almost from the minute Liz mentioned the idea. I'm going to go with gratitude. I want to practice gratitude. I know that sounds hokey, but instead of concentrating on the negative, I want to look at the positive side of life. Hi, Mom. Zoe walked into the kitchen not more than 10 minutes after Julia woke up from an afternoon snooze. She fell into the seat across from her, yawning. New Year's was always a lazy day around their house. Did you have a good time last night? Julia asked.
Yeah,
Zoe murmured with no real enthusiasm. Julia knew that the church youth leaders had kept the kids active with swimming and roller skating, plus a number of games that included basketball and volleyball. The night ended with a huge breakfast at 5 a.m., and from there everyone went home.
Did you and Dad have fun without us?
We had a wonderful, romantic evening. Julia wanted Zoe to realize that she and Peter had a life beyond that of being parents. Zoe frowned, yawning again. She stood and made her way back to her bedroom.
What was that all about?
Peter asked, coming in from the family room. Julia smiled.
Haven't a clue.
Peter held out his hand. Come sit with me. A dozen objections ran through Julia's mind. The kitchen was a mess, and she was behind with the laundry. But she couldn't refuse him. They snuggled up on the leather couch with Julia's head on his shoulder and his arm around her. It was peaceful. The only sound came from the television, but the volume kept purposely low. Peter slipped his hand inside Julia's blouse and cupped her breast.
I like the way we christened the new year.
His mouth nibbled at her neck with a series of kisses that grew in length and intensity. Julia straightened, and their lips met in a kiss they normally reserved for special nights.
There are advantages to one's children growing up,
Peter whispered as his hands grew bolder with her breasts.
Oh, they seem to stay in their rooms a great deal more.
That they do. Julia twined her arms around his neck and luxuriated in his kiss.
Mom, Dad?
Adam walked into the family room, his face clouded with sleep. Peter quickly removed his hand, and an embarrassed Julia tucked in her blouse. Their son took one look at them and frowned darkly.
What's going on?
Nothing,
Julia mumbled, glancing away.
I thought you two would be over the mushy stuff by now.
He muttered disgustedly.
It's embarrassing to catch your parents in a flip-flop.
Peter grinned.
You just wait. When you're 40, you'll see things very differently.
Adam gave them an odd grimace and disappeared back down the hallway to his room. Peter reached for Julia again.
Where were we?
This is so nice. Liz Kenyon said, sliding into the booth across from Claire in the Victorian tea room on Friday afternoon. Claire was pleased. No, she was relieved to see her friend. Even though they'd had breakfast with the others just the day before, there were things she needed to talk about that she wasn't comfortable saying in front of the whole group. Liz was the person who'd understand, who might even have some practical advice, or at least encouragement. Liz watched her for a moment.
Are you okay? With anyone else, Claire would have plastered on a phony smile and offered reassurances.
She didn't think she could fool Liz, nor did she want to. Liz studied her, staring hard.
Claire, what is it?
Something to do with Michael, no doubt. Claire nodded and chewed at her lower lip.
Alex and Michael have been talking.
A couple of days ago, Alex, oh so casually, said that Michael might be attending his soccer games. Now I find out he'll be there tomorrow afternoon.
And you won't be there if your ex is?
She scowled. Can you blame me? Liz patted her arm.
No, I don't blame you. It's perfectly understandable. I wouldn't go under those circumstances either.
Claire instantly felt better.
What am I supposed to do now?
What do you mean?
I enjoy watching Alex play. I'm the one who drove him to and from soccer practice for the last 12 years. The other parents are my friends. And not Michael's?
No. It'll be awkward for everyone if Michael shows up. Not just me, but the other parents, too. His presence will be a distraction. Besides, I'm scheduled to work the concession stand.
I see. Liz was quiet for a few moments, looking thoughtful. Then she spoke.
I think I have a solution. You're going to contact Michael yourself, and the two of you are going to decide which games each of you will attend.
Why do I have to be the one who calls him? Can't Michael understand this is awkward for me? For all the parents?
It's unlikely. Men don't think that far ahead. It had been 13 months since she'd last heard Michael's voice. Claire wasn't sure if she could trust herself not to vent her anger. Liz couldn't understand that, couldn't know. If her friends had any idea of the rage she still battled, it would frighten them.
I can't do it. You can and you will. All you need to do is make a phone call. Suggest you split the games up. He attends half, and you attend the other half. It'll save you both a lot of angst.
Couldn't I write him instead? Claire wondered why she hadn't thought of that sooner. A written explanation wouldn't leave room for any misunderstanding. She'd be clear, succinct, and to the point. She could take the schedule and underline the games he could attend and tell him to stay away from the ones she had selected.
Claire? Claire looked up. You didn't hear me, did you?
Liz was right. She'd been so caught up in her own thoughts, she hadn't heard a word in the last few minutes.
I said, your heart will tell you the best thing to do. Now that was an interesting concept. If she'd listened to her heart, Michael would have died an agonizing death 2 years ago. And she'd be making license plates in a federal pen. At noon on Saturday, Claire checked her email messages for the sixth time that day. It hadn't occurred to her until after her lunch with Liz that she could contact Michael without speaking to him or sending a letter. Email. She hardly ever used it herself, since she considered it a time waster. But she remembered that Michael, who was enthralled with anything high-tech, did much of his correspondence by email. Her message had been short. Michael. Unless you want an embarrassing scene, I suggest you stay away from Alex's soccer game this afternoon. Next Tuesday's game is all yours. You will receive a schedule of which games I'm attending. You're free to attend the other half. It's up to you. Hugs and kisses. Not Claire. It had taken her most of an hour to write those few words. She hoped the small touch of humor would help. By 1 o'clock, her stomach was so queasy, she couldn't even manage a cup of tea. She hadn't asked him to email her back, but had assumed he would, if for no other reason than to confirm he'd read her message. Claire needed his assurance that he'd do nothing to embarrass her in front of her friends. She should have known better than to expect cooperation from Michael. At 2, just an hour before she had to leave for the game, Claire couldn't bear it another minute. She reached for the phone. She hadn't called the dealership in a very long time, but the telephone number was still on her speed dial. She punched the button. Then she heard a voice she had hoped never to hear again.
Craig Chevrolet, Michael Craig speaking.
She was unprepared for the effect his voice would have on her, but she wasn't about to let him know it.
Well, hello, Michael. There was a short, shocked pause.
Claire?
I guess you haven't read your email.
You sent me an email?
What for?
It's about Alex. I understand you're planning to attend his soccer games.
Claire could feel Michael's tension through the phone line.
Do I need to call my attorney? Is that what you're saying?
Claire laughed softly.
I can't believe you want to tangle with Lillian Case again.
Do you enjoy this? Do you get some kind of sick thrill out of making my life miserable?
Claire could almost see his face getting red. She could feel his anger, and she loved it. Had she known the sense of triumph, of satisfaction this would give her, she'd have phoned him much sooner.
I didn't say anything about preventing you from seeing his games, did I?
She asked, again maintaining a cool, even voice.
If you want to go to Alex's soccer matches, That's perfectly fine with me. So do I. He's my son, too. But I think it'd be best all the way around for us not to show up at the same time. That way, Alex can concentrate on his game instead of what's happening off-field between his parents.
All right, Michael said, sounding guarded. I assume Alex told you I was planning to be there today.
Thursday night, he dropped the news. But that's not enough notice for me. Keith's mother asked me to help her at the concession stand, and it would be irresponsible to cancel at the last minute.
In other words, you don't want me there this afternoon.
Exactly. He hesitated.
All right. But I'm going to next Tuesday's game.
And I won't, she said sweetly. Now, was that so hard?
No,
he admitted grudgingly. Goodbye, Michael. Claire replaced the receiver. Slumping in the chair, she buried her face in her hands. It shocked her to realize how badly she was trembling. She'd talked to her ex-husband. During their conversation, she'd felt rage, exhilaration, and a sense of bitter victory. What she felt now was despair. This lunch was destined to be even worse than Karen had imagined. Again, she wondered, what had she been thinking? Accepting her mother's invitation to lunch at the yacht club? She had been so caught off guard by her mother's call that she had accepted before learning that Victoria was coming too. She would have found an excuse to get out of it, but with her current cash flow difficulties, she wasn't above accepting a free meal. As Karen stood in the foyer of the yacht club restaurant, she saw her mother pull up to the valet attendant and step out of her Lexus. Catherine Curtis wore a pastel blue linen dress with a huge, wide-brimmed matching hat and white gloves. Victoria looked like her twin, only she had on a tailored blue suit with a white collar. It went without saying that her mother and sister weren't going to approve of her jean overalls from Old Navy. "Hi, Mom," Karen said, standing when they entered the yacht club. Catherine's expression spoke volumes. "Karen?" She leaned forward and presented her cheek for Karen to kiss. "You're early," was her sister's sole greeting. "My car's on the fritz, so I took the bus." Her mother and Victoria exchanged glances.
"Don't worry," Karen said in a stage whisper. "No one saw me get off the bus. Certainly no one who'd connect me with the two of you."
Her mother ignored the comment.
"Shall we have the hostess seat us?"
"Yes, let's," her sister piped in with phony enthusiasm. The two headed in the direction of the restaurant, leaving Karen to trail behind. The temptation to slip away was almost overwhelming, but the consequences wouldn't be worth it. So, like an obedient child, she followed them. The hostess directed them to a window table. After they had all had an opportunity to peruse the menu, Catherine focused her attention on Victoria.
"How's Roger?"
Victoria smiled benignly at her mother.
"Busy, as always."
It wasn't long before the two of them were involved in a meandering conversation about people who were of little or no interest to Karen. She tried to comment once, but was cut off. She began to feel more and more out of place. It was just as bad as she'd feared. Worse. Suddenly her mother turned her attention entirely on Karen.
"You haven't contributed to the conversation once."
There was a very good reason for that. She couldn't get a word in edgewise.
"What would you like to know?"
she asked carefully. Catherine raised her eyebrows.
"You could tell me about school. I always knew you'd end up teaching. You're so good with children."
Victoria piped up. "Mom's right. You'd make a wonderful teacher. You're enjoying it, aren't you?" Karen felt gratified by the unexpected praise.
"Well, enjoying isn't exactly the word I'd use. It's, a challenge. What I'm really hoping for is a part in a commercial. I'm trying out for another spot next week. The director liked me the last time and wants to see me again."
Her mother's eyes narrowed.
"I thought you were finally putting your college degree to good use."
Your father and I paid a great deal of money for your education. You can't imagine how much it distressed us to hear that you're more interested in cleaning toilets than in making something worthwhile of your life. Karen forced herself to swallow a snide retort.
I deeply appreciate my education, Mom, which was true, but only because it allowed her to support herself while trying out for acting roles.
What about this director? He wants you to audition for another commercial?
It's for a dog food commercial. He told my agent he liked my style, and
I'll just bet he did, her mother said, lips pinched tight.
Exactly what are you going to have to do for that role?
Enough was enough. As politely as possible, Karen placed the pink linen napkin on the table and picked up her purse.
I think it'd be best if I left.
She kept her voice expressionless.
Sit down right now, her mother ordered. I won't have you making a scene by leaving before we've had our lunch.
If you're worried about creating a scene, then I suggest that the next time we meet, you refrain from insulting me.
All I said was,
thank you for lunch. Karen did her best to hide her anger and disappointment. She should have known better. Whenever she saw her mother, they always played out some version of this encounter. The simple truth was that her family didn't respect her and had no confidence in her talent or apparently her judgment. And that hurt.
This story is continued on the other side of the cassette. From the Diary of Julia Murchison, January 25th. I haven't been feeling well for weeks, and with my newfound determination to take care of myself physically, I've made an appointment to see Dr. Snyder, even though it means I'll have to leave the Thursday breakfast group early. I guess I haven't fully recovered from that virus I had in November. I assumed I'd feel better after the holidays, but I don't. In fact, I seem to be more tired now than ever. Peter, who almost never complains, mentioned it at breakfast this morning. But this is more than exhaustion. I'm constantly running to the bathroom. Could be I've developed a bladder infection. I certainly hope not. My whole system is out of whack. Even my period is late. I'll be 40 this year, but I didn't expect menopause to hit me this early. Reading this, it almost sounds like I'm pregnant. It's been so many years since I had the kids. I didn't put it together until just this minute. But that's impossible. With the flu and the busyness of the season, Peter and I haven't been that active sexually. And I've been on the pill for years. I'm not pregnant. I couldn't be. I'm methodical about my birth control pill. I don't miss. Ever. I refuse to think like this. A pregnancy now would be a disaster. I'm finished with the baby stage and couldn't imagine going back. I'm ending this right here because I can't deal with what I'm thinking. I am not pregnant. I don't want to be pregnant. And I refuse to torment myself with something that has only a 1% chance of being true. I already told you a pregnancy just isn't possible.
The urine test confirms otherwise, Dr. Snyder said quietly.
I can't be pregnant.
Julia didn't know why she felt the need to argue when a pregnancy was now a certainty.
With the pill, there's always that slight risk, the doctor murmured.
Julia adamantly shook her head.
You say you never missed a pill? Not even once?
Not even once, Julia cried, fighting back emotions so negative her voice actually shook.
Dr. Snyder read the chart. What about when you had that flu virus?
I took my pills.
You kept them down?
Julia frowned.
Down? What do you mean, down?
According to the chart, you suffered projectile vomiting for 3 days.
Julia's forehead broke into a sweat. Numbness spread through her arms and legs. She nodded.
And I didn't eat solids for a full 7 days.
Dr. Snyder patted her shoulder and quietly slipped out of the room.
Julia slowly dressed. Her fingers trembled as she fastened the buttons of her blouse. She walked out of the office in a stupor. The next thing Julia knew, she was at Benjamin Franklin Elementary, the grade school where Peter had been principal for the last 4 years. Peter stood when she entered his office. "Julia, what's wrong?" He left his desk and placed an arm around her shoulders, then gently guided her to a chair. Julia sank down gratefully. She felt on the verge of collapse. Peter appeared to sense the gravity of the situation without her having to say a word. "What is it?" "Sweetheart, tell me." Her eyes and throat burned with the need to cry, but she refused to allow it. "You saw Dr. Snyder?" She nodded wildly. "The flu," she managed to say, willing herself not to weep. Peter's hands clasped hers. "It was more than the flu?" Julia whispered. "Yes." Her husband went pale. "It isn't cancer, is it?"
"No, you idiot!"
she shouted, knowing even as she spoke how unreasonable she was being.
"I'm pregnant!"
Peter stared at her blankly. Then his frown slowly evaporated into a soft, teasing smile.
"You're joking, aren't you?"
"Do I look like I'm joking?"
"No."
He hesitated, confusion in his eyes.
"You're really pregnant? But how?"
"Apparently I threw up the birth control pills when I had the flu a couple of months back."
Peter started to chuckle, but she cut him off abruptly.
"Don't laugh!"
A pregnancy wasn't a laughing matter, not at this stage of her life. She was through with being a stay-at-home mother. She didn't regret any of it, but that phase was over now. She was still actively involved in her children's lives, but as teenagers, they were less dependent, required less of her time. Finally, it was her turn, and she was unwilling and unable to go back and retrace her steps.
"You find this amusing, don't you?"
she yelled.
"We have 2 teenage children, Peter. Can you imagine what a baby would do to our family?"
Peter's eyes filled with sympathy.
"Julia, a pregnancy isn't the end of the world."
"Oh, sure, you can say that. But it isn't you who'll be getting up in the middle of the night. No one has a child at our age."
"It happens all the time. We'll adjust."
"You might, but I won't. I don't want this child."
There, she'd said it, those dreadful words. But God help her, they were the truth. Peter gazed at her as though he hadn't heard.
"Give yourself time. It's not so bad. Having another baby will be kind of exciting."
Her husband didn't understand. He apparently shared none of her qualms. If anything, he seemed pleased, thrilled even, excited. Everything Julia wasn't. From the diary of Liz Kenyon, January 28th. "I'm feeling depressed. I'm 57 and alone. Never in a million years did I think such a thing would happen. This morning, studying my reflection in the mirror, I was forced to confront the truth. 57 isn't that young. As though losing Steve and having the children move away isn't bad enough, now I'm facing yet another loss. This one as devastating as the others. My youth. To complicate matters, I'm convinced that Sean Jameson is partly responsible for this unwelcome and unappreciated epiphany. Rumor has it he's dating the new physical therapist. I couldn't care less."
"Yeah, right. As Karen would say."
Thursday morning breakfast club. Everyone had already arrived by the time Julia showed up for the weekly breakfast meeting on the first Thursday of February. Liz had ordered her usual coffee and croissant and looked wonderful in her pinstriped power suit. Her dark hair was stylishly short and utterly feminine. Julia knew her friend's life was much easier now that the nurse's strike had been averted. Claire had her double-shot espresso and currant scone, and sat next to Liz at the table for 4. She looked less harried now than she had when they'd first met, Julia noted. Still, the recent contact with her ex had thrown her, and her resentment and anger had quickly surfaced. Julia believed the group had been a good sounding board for her, and more than that, a real support. Karen was there, too, with her multi-mix latte, a different flavor combination each week. Last week, it had been a coconut cream concoction, and the aroma had made Julia nauseous. She hadn't told them about the pregnancy yet, wanting to delay it until she knew if there'd actually be a pregnancy. Her three friends greeted her with welcoming smiles as she joined them. She ordered herbal tea and a blueberry muffin at the counter and carried them to the table where the others waited. "Morning. How's everyone this week?" A chorus of goods followed. It was almost always like this. They started off slowly, each talking a little about the week that had passed, then gradually gaining momentum. Karen animatedly described a recent audition for a dog food commercial. Apparently, the Cocker Spaniel had taken an instant dislike to her and growled every time she'd attempted to say her lines. Not surprisingly, she didn't get the part. But the way she told the story had them all laughing and offering sympathy. She finished with a heavy theatrical sigh. "It seems my entire career rests on next time." As they continued to talk about Karen's audition, Julia noticed that Liz had grown quiet. She wondered if her friend's lack of enthusiasm had anything to do with that doctor she'd mentioned a couple of times. Liz's offhand manner when she'd told the group about him had instantly signaled that there was more to the situation. "Have you heard anything more from your doctor friend?" she asked. Liz shook her head. It was obvious from the way she shifted in her chair and stared off into the distance that she didn't want to talk about Dr. Jameson. Karen leaned across the table. "You're interested in him, aren't you? I thought you were when you first mentioned his name, and now I'm sure of it." "Really, I'm not interested," Liz insisted, but she didn't sound convincing. "Yeah, right," Karen said good-naturedly. Claire gave a deep-throated laugh. "Who do you think you're kidding? Somehow or other, the good doctor turns up in our conversation practically every week." "What about you, Claire?" Julia asked. "How's the situation between Mick and Alex?" A pained look came over Claire's face. "Mick isn't speaking to his brother yet, but I'm sure that eventually they'll settle this. You hate seeing your boys fighting about their father, don't you?" Claire twisted her mouth. "Does anyone mind if we don't talk about Michael? I was just starting to get my appetite back." They all grinned. Claire relaxed, and Julia realized anew how hard her friend was struggling to keep the resentment out of her life. "Have you talked to your mother lately?" Liz asked Karen. Karen's reaction was immediate. She stiffened. "Not a word. What about your sister? I thought you said Victoria called you recently." "She did. That's twice within the last month, which has to be something of a record." "Any reason she's calling you more frequently?" "None that I can figure out. Except I'm beginning to wonder if my sister's as happy as she leads everyone to believe."
"What makes you say that?"
"First, she hardly ever has people over. Second, I hardly ever see her and Roger together. Plus, that last time she called, it sounded like she'd been crying."
"Did you ask her about it?"
"Sure I did. She said she'd caught a bad cold."
She rolled her eyes.
"She seems to be reaching out to you now," Julia said.
"Maybe she's hoping you'll reach back,"
Claire added.
Karen frowned.
"You think?"
Everyone nodded.
There was silence for a minute or two.
"What about the guy you were telling us about a little while ago?"
Claire asked suddenly.
"I mentioned Glenn."
Liz leaned closer.
"Tell us more. We're living vicariously through you."
Karen grinned and flipped a long strand of brown hair over her shoulder.
"Sorry, there's nothing to tell. He's a high school chemistry teacher. We met briefly in a parking lot across from the school where I was subbing. He's not my type."
"Damn," Liz muttered, and they all laughed. Claire turned to Julia.
"Just a minute. What about you? Everyone else has been doing all the talking. How's your week been?"
Julia stared down at her hands. She hadn't planned to tell her friends about the pregnancy until March. when she reached the 12-week point, but she wanted to confide in them now. Wanted it so much. She sighed deeply and looked up.
I'm pregnant.
The other three stared at her as if they weren't sure they should believe her.
You're joking, right?
Karen said.
I'm afraid not.
In case you haven't guessed, I'm not particularly pleased.
Oh, Julia,
Liz said, her eyes warm with sympathy.
What are you going to do?
Claire asked next.
Do? What can I do? I'll have this baby.
And resent it for the rest of my life, she thought to herself.
What does Peter say?
Liz asked. Julia laughed humorlessly.
Peter is positively delighted.
Claire groaned.
Figures.
He loves children. He's always wanted more.
I was the one who insisted we stop at two.
What about the kids? Liz asked.
We haven't told them yet.
Julia dreaded the thought. Her children were typical self-involved teenagers, and their entire world focused on their own needs. Peter had a blind spot when it came to his children. He sincerely believed they'd be just as delighted as he was. Julia doubted it.
You have to adjust to it yourself first, Liz said and patted her hand.
If you need anything, you holler, Karen said. I don't know much about babies, but I'll do what I can.
I will too, Claire assured her. You have my complete support.
And mine, Liz promised.
Thank you, Julia whispered, grateful for these three dear friends.
She had the feeling she was going to be calling upon them often in the months to come.
Mom?
Claire heard Alex's voice over the telephone line.
What's up? I need a favor. I need to write a makeup test this afternoon.
Because of a recent soccer tournament, Alex had missed two important tests.
English or algebra? Algebra. Mr. Lawrence said if I didn't take the test this afternoon, he'll give me a zero. And if I get a zero, you can kiss my chances of getting into Berkeley goodbye.
Did you study?
Of course I did. I'll ace it if...
If what?
Mom,
he said, then hesitated.
I wouldn't ask if there was any other way.
What? Claire was growing impatient. Intuition told her she wasn't going to like this. Alex was generally straightforward when he wanted something. There had to be a reason he was being so indirect.
I told Dad I'd pick him up at the hospital, and now I can't.
Claire's anger was immediate.
You're asking me to chauffeur your father around?
Yes.
Alex's voice sounded small.
I know you and Dad are divorced, but that doesn't mean you can't be civilized.
Claire gritted her teeth and waited for the anger to pass.
I'm civilized, Alex. Are you suggesting I'm not?
No, Mom, please. I don't want to get into this with you. I wouldn't have asked if it wasn't important.
What about his friend? Surely Miranda could pick him up.
She can't just take off from work, you know.
Claire hadn't realized nail technicians were on such tight schedules.
Can't he get a taxi?
Yeah, I guess. Only I told him I'd be there, and you always said it's important for us to keep our commitments.
Moral righteousness.
He was bringing out the heavy artillery. Something wasn't logical here. A thought occurred to her that hadn't earlier.
Why can't he drive himself? Mom, I'm between classes and I don't have time to discuss this. But apparently Dad's having some tests done at the hospital. He's not supposed to drive.
Oh?
She paused. What kind of tests?
I'm not sure.
It was his turn to pause.
Will you do it or not?
He asked more sharply. She desperately wanted to tell Alex that Michael could find his own damn way home. But deep down, Claire knew that if she refused, Alex would skip the exam and take the zero in order to fulfill his obligation to his father.
All right, she muttered with ill grace.
She was angry for allowing herself to be maneuvered into something she didn't want to do. Alex quickly gave her the necessary information.
Thanks, Mom.
I knew I could count on you.
The line was disconnected before she had a chance to respond. On the drive to Willow Grove Memorial, Claire repeatedly played through the scenario in her mind, imagining Michael's reactions and rehearsing her own. This would be the first time they had seen each other outside a courtroom since the divorce became final. Michael was supposed to be waiting for her in the hospital foyer. All that was required of her, according to Alex, was to drive up to the front doors. Claire was shocked. Michael looked dreadful, pale and gaunt. He'd lost at least 30 pounds. He frowned when he saw her and walked slowly over to the car. Where's Alex? Claire was staggered by the differences she saw in him.
Taking an algebra midterm, she replied stiffly.
Climb in. Once inside the vehicle, Michael closed his eyes and leaned against the headrest. He'd broken into a sweat. Whatever the tests were for, they must have been hellish. Claire struggled not to react with pity or fear. Struggled not to react as a wife would.
I appreciate this, Claire, he said, his voice barely audible.
I won't pretend it was convenient, she said, keeping her voice cool. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Alex. Michael didn't answer, and when she turned to look at him, he was staring out the side window. So he intended to give her the silent treatment.
Okay,
fine. Suddenly he spoke.
Stop the car.
His voice was harsh, urgent. He pointed to a side street and added,
Hurry, please.
The second she eased to a stop at the curb, the passenger door flew open. Michael half fell out of the car, bent over and vomited on the sidewalk. Doubled over, he heaved until there was nothing left. When he'd finished, he climbed back into the car, more ashen than before. That must have been one hell of a test you had. Or do you have the flu? He was silent for a moment.
I wasn't at the hospital for tests, and I don't have the flu.
Claire glanced in his direction and waited for him to explain, her hand on the ignition key.
I'm undergoing chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy? Michael? You have cancer? Claire whispered.
Nervous about confronting the children with news of her pregnancy, Julia took the chicken casserole from the oven and carried it to the table. She'd gone to extra trouble this evening, preparing a family favorite, accompanied by fresh green beans and hot rolls, and followed by dessert. Peter was the first one in the kitchen. His eyes met hers, and Julia read the question in his gaze.
We'll tell them tonight.
Julia nodded.
Adam, Zoe!
Peter yelled.
Dinner!
As though he was doing his parents a favor, Adam slouched into the kitchen. He pulled out his chair and fell into it. Zoe arrived a minute later. Once they were all seated, they bowed their heads for a brief prayer. As soon as they'd finished, Peter reached for the spoon to serve himself some casserole.
Your mother and I would like to talk to you both after dinner, he said casually.
Talk to us?
Zoe asked.
About what? Adam pressed. Me driving?
Adam was due to get his driver's license soon. Already he was pressuring Peter and Julia about purchasing an extra vehicle for him. Naturally, he assured them, he'd get a job to pay for the insurance, gas, and maintenance. Julia stabbed a green bean. She didn't have the heart to tell Adam that with the extra financial burden of a third child, there wouldn't be money for a car. Zoe tossed her brother a superior look.
I know what it is, Zoe burst out excitedly. We're taking a family vacation this year, aren't we?
Julia and Peter exchanged glances. Zoe's eyes brightened.
We're going to the Grand Canyon, right?
Do you mind if we put this discussion off until after dinner? Julia said, wishing Peter hadn't announced their intention beforehand.
Just tell us what it is,
Zoe pleaded.
Yeah, Adam agreed. Why don't you tell us?
Maybe we should just tell them and be done with it, Peter said, looking at Julia.
Realizing she couldn't postpone it any longer, Julia set her fork down and placed her hands in her lap. Your father and I have some good news.
She was determined to put a positive slant on this, despite her own less than enthusiastic attitude.
"We're headed for the Grand Canyon!" Zoe shouted.
"I'm not sure a baby is what either of you have in mind."
"Yellowstone Park!"
Adam's eyes flashed with enthusiasm. "I could help with the driving. We could be there in 18 hours. We'd stay at the National Park."
"Baby!"
The excitement vanished from Zoe's face as she took in her father's words.
"What's this about a baby?"
Julia wished her husband had led into the subject with a little more finesse. Doing her best to appear pleased, she leaned forward and looked both her children in the eye. "I'm pregnant. Your baby brother or sister is due in early September." Both children stared at Julia as though they found this impossible to believe.
"I didn't know women as old as Mom could have babies,"
Adam said. Peter did nothing to hide his amusement.
"This may come as a shock, but your mother isn't old."
Zoe cocked her head to one side.
"You're honestly having a baby? You mean we aren't going on a family vacation?"
"Not this year," Julia said. "And probably not for the next 5 or more," she thought to herself.
"Where will a baby sleep?"
Adam asked.
"We won't know that until the baby's born," Peter answered. "If it's a boy, then eventually he'll be with you. A girl will move in with Zoe at some point."
"If the baby's a girl, she'll be in the same bedroom as me?"
Zoe's outrage echoed in each word.
"I have the smallest bedroom already. Make Adam change rooms with me, then."
"Zoe, there's no need to worry about this now. After the baby's born, he or she will be with your mother and me for the first few months."
"Why can't you keep him with you all the time?"
"Don't you think you're both being a little selfish here?" Peter asked mildly.
Julia could tell he was disappointed by their children's reaction. Well, she'd done her best to warn him. Zoe stood and glared across the table at her and Peter.
"Oh, no one my age has a baby brother or sister. This is so embarrassing. I hate you for doing this to us."
She raced out of the kitchen. A few seconds later, her bedroom door slammed, the sound echoing throughout the house. Adam didn't say anything for a couple of minutes. Then he muttered,
"This means you won't be able to afford a car for me, doesn't it?"
"We don't know that yet," Julia hurried to answer before Peter could say something too blunt and destroy their son's dream. "Maybe next year." Wordlessly, Adam shoved his plate away. He left the table and marched down the hallway leading to his room. Seconds later, his door banged shut too. The kitchen was suddenly silent. Julia thought she was going to throw up. This had gone even more badly than she'd feared. She'd known the children would be surprised and perhaps embarrassed, but she hadn't expected them to react this vehemently. Peter leaned back in his chair.
"It didn't go well, did it?"
The knot in Julia's gut tightened. "No, Peter, it didn't go well." Donna DeGuyer, the hospital social services director, peeked inside Liz's office on Thursday afternoon.
"He's here."
"Who?" Liz asked, playing dumb.
"You know who. I just saw Dr. Jameson down the hall, and he's headed in this direction."
Liz's pulse reacted immediately.
"Really?" "He's probably going to ask you out."
Liz didn't think it was probable at all. She'd spoken her mind to the good doctor and hadn't heard from him since. He'd kept his distance and was dating someone else. No sooner had Donna left than Sean appeared, looking better than any man had a right to.
"Good thing you're still here," he murmured.
"I thought you might be." Liz glanced at the clock on her desk, surprised to see that it was after 6:30.
"I was just finishing up some paperwork."
"You sure you weren't waiting for me?" She bit back the reply that sprang to her lips. Sean would believe what he wanted to believe, which was, apparently, that she spent her days longing to hear from him. Since it wasn't far from the truth, she let it go.
"You have plans for tonight?"
Liz hesitated, but not for long.
No.
He smiled that sexy, charming grin of his, and her heart began to race. How about a drink? I thought you were dating, what's her name? The physical therapist. He shrugged. Not anymore. She's too manipulative. It took her a moment to catch the pun, bad as it was. Then, despite herself, she smiled. A drink wouldn't hurt. Where? The seaside? Sure. Sean glanced at his watch. Shall we meet there in 15 minutes? Fine. He flashed her another easy smile, then turned and walked away. 12 minutes later, Liz was fortunate enough to find a spot in the parking lot outside the popular restaurant. Here goes nothing, she said as she slid out of her car. At the very least, she'd have something to tell the breakfast group next Thursday. They'd met that morning, and Claire had revealed that Michael was undergoing cancer treatment. Claire vacillated between pity and wanting to remain indifferent. With one breath, she'd say it was Miranda's problem. With the next, she'd worry frantically about his prognosis and the chemo's side effects. Julia had finally told her children she was pregnant, with predictable results. And Karen was still upset about being disliked by the Cocker Spaniel, as if her entire career hung in the balance. Liz had listened to them all, but she'd had nothing to report and had left with the feeling that her own life lacked meaning. The seaside's bar was smoky and crowded. A table became vacant when the hostess let its occupants into the dining room. Moving quickly, Liz claimed the space. A couple of minutes later, a harried waitress approached. Liz ordered a glass of Merlot. Sean arrived before her wine did. He paid for her drink and ordered an old-fashioned for himself. Soon they were deep in conversation. Time flew by as they moved from one heated debate to the next. They shared little in common, and they were directly opposed on practically every subject, so the conversation didn't lack for stimulation. They argued every point, joked, teased, and laughed. Finally, Liz noticed that the restaurant was closing for the night. Sean looked at his watch. It's 11:30. Way past my bedtime. What about you? Liz groaned. Mine, too. I need to be at the hospital early in the morning. The bill had already been paid, so they got up to leave. Sean helped her on with her jacket and walked her to her car. Just to be on the safe side, I'll follow you home. She was touched by his protectiveness. There's no need to do that. Don't argue with me, Elizabeth. I've spent the entire evening arguing with you, she reminded him sweetly. You'll learn soon enough that I win most arguments. Yes, sir, she muttered sarcastically. Although, I'd say it was a draw. He grinned at that, but didn't respond. Sean followed her home as he'd promised, and when she pulled into the garage, he eased his vehicle behind hers, turning off the ignition. Frowning, Liz climbed out of her car and met him. Thanks again. I had an enjoyable evening. So did I. He reached for her, and after the briefest of hesitations, she leaned into him and accepted his kiss. His mouth was warm and moist and firm, and she felt sensations she hadn't experienced in more than 6 years. She wound her arms around his neck, and he held her tightly, his hands finding the small of her back and pressing their bodies close. He wanted her, and she was keenly aware of it. Invite me in, he whispered. I'll turn an enjoyable evening into a pleasurable one for both of us, he promised, his voice husky with desire. Liz would be lying to herself if she didn't admit how tempted she was. She rested her forehead against his shoulder and waited for reason and sanity to return. Don't think, he pleaded, just feel. His lips nibbling at her neck and earlobe made for a persuasive argument. She lifted her head and placed her hands on either side of his jaw. Sean, your offer is tempting. His eyes clouded with passion, cleared and sharpened. But if I was in my 20s, I'd probably do it.
It would be the easiest thing in the world to fall into bed with you. But I was married for 31 years. And in that time, I learned that sex is more than pleasure. It's commitment and communication, shared dreams and lives. It's wonderful. But for me, it has to mean something more than a nightcap. I enjoyed myself tonight. I enjoyed being with you.
In other words, thanks, but no thanks. Some other time?
She hesitated. It was more complicated than that, but she doubted he understood. Sort of. He heaved a ragged sigh.
Tell you what I'll do. I'll wait until you're ready, and then you can give me a call.
What?
I don't ask a woman twice, Liz.
She glared at him. Furious, he'd turned this into a battle of wills. He hadn't heard a word she'd said. You'll have a very long wait, Sean. He chuckled, evidently amused.
I doubt that,
he said with maddening confidence.
You'll come around soon enough. And when you do, I'll be ready, willing, and able.
From the diary of Karen Curtis, February 23rd. Glenn Ternavsky, the high school chemistry teacher I met in the parking lot a few weeks ago, called me after school yesterday. I guess he knew I needed some emotional support after 8+ hours with fifth graders. Glenn is actually a very nice guy. Quiet, calm, a good sense of humor. He's different from the guys I know through drama. But as quiet as he is, he's one of the most comfortable men I've ever met. And when I analyzed why, I discovered it's because he listens. Not only does he listen, he seems to appreciate what I have to say. He's not my type, though. Too even-tempered. Not bland, I don't mean that, but predictable. There's no fire in his belly, no all-consuming zeal. We're going to a movie tomorrow night. I probably shouldn't have agreed. I hate to string him along, but he did ask. And it isn't like I've got hordes of men clamoring at my door. More's the pity. I love movies, and I don't mean to complain, but I find Glenn unexciting. Comfortable, but unexciting. By the time 6 o'clock arrived on Saturday night, Karen had serious doubts about her 7 o'clock date with Glenn Ternavsky. She worried that she was using him to flatter her sagging ego, and worse, that he might read more into their date than he should. Friday night, she hadn't felt too concerned about this prospect. But in the light of day, her behavior didn't seem fair. She stressed the just friends stipulation. But still, she'd halfway decided to phone and beg off when she got a call. If luck was with her, it would be Glenn, and he'd be the one canceling. That way, the problem would be solved without any action on her part. Hello, she said cheerfully. No response. Hello, she said again, more loudly this time. Silence. With that, she banged down the receiver emphatically enough to make the person on the other end regret phoning. Glenn Ternavsky arrived 5 minutes early with a bouquet of pink carnations. Karen instantly felt guilty for wanting to cancel. The movie was delightful, and they both laughed their way through it. Afterward, they shared a gourmet veggie pizza and glasses of red wine at a popular Italian restaurant in the area. Despite her reservations about the wisdom of seeing Glenn, Karen enjoyed herself and their time together. Her one disappointment was that she was home by 11. When she invited him in for coffee, Glenn politely declined. As she entered her apartment, she couldn't help wondering if she'd passed muster. The first thing she noticed was the flashing light of her answering machine. In replaying the tape, she discovered there were no less than 6 hang-ups. One she could understand, even 2. But 6? She'd just pulled on her pajamas when the phone rang again. Karen grabbed the receiver. Hello? She yelled. Silence. Karen was about to slam down the receiver and unplug her phone when she heard a soft, unrecognizable female voice say her name.
It's Victoria.
Are you the one who's been calling and hanging up? Why?
What's the matter with you?
You scared me, damn it,
Karen asked aggressively.
I can't talk any louder. Roger might hear me.
You don't want him to know you're on the phone?
No.
Karen thought she heard a soft intake of breath that might have been a sob. A sense of urgency filled Karen. Something was terribly wrong.
Tell me what happened.
Victoria hesitated, sobbed once, then spoke again. Her voice so low Karen had to concentrate in order to make out the words.
Roger and I had an argument.
Is everything all right between you now? Again the hesitation.
No.
Do you want me to come and get you?
No.
Her sister's response was sharp and immediate. Karen's hand tightened around the receiver as a horrifying thought occurred to her.
Is there a reason you don't want me to see you?
A soft sob, then.
Yes.
A chill ran down her spine.
The son of a bitch hit you, didn't he?
From the diary of Claire Craig, March 9th. Most of my day was spent with Michael. Not with him, as in the same room or even in the same vicinity, but I thought about him constantly. He was back in the hospital for his second bout of chemotherapy, and Alex was scheduled to pick him up at the same time as before. Apparently, Miranda can't be bothered. Her excuse is that she's building her customer base and can't be dragged away from the nail clinic without missing appointments.
I can't stand the way Michael defends her.
I'm confused about my feelings for Michael right now. Why should I care so much? But I do. Especially since Michael's condition appears to be fairly serious. He's avoided my questions so far. But from what I've been able to learn, it's some form of liver cancer. Alex doesn't know any more details than I do. But this can't be good. Thursday morning breakfast club. Karen arrived at Mocha Moments early and ordered her current favorite latte, a caramel and mocha combination that tasted like a liquid candy bar with twice as many calories. She carried her drink to the table and slid into a chair, planning to talk to her friends about Victoria. She had great news, too, about getting a hairspray commercial, and she was eager to let everyone know. Still, it was her sister's dilemma that preoccupied her most. Liz entered the coffee shop and, after ordering her coffee and croissant, walked over to Karen's table. She wore a dark red suit with a double-breasted jacket and straight skirt. The matching high heels were fabulous. They made her look more powerful, yet strikingly feminine. She sat down gracefully. Good morning. You're bright and early this morning.
Morning,
Karen returned with a smile. She wished again that her mother was more like Liz. Claire and Julia came in a few minutes later. Soon all four were at the table, each with her signature breakfast. Karen was here when I arrived, Liz said. And the other two women turned to her. This was obviously Liz's way of letting them know there was something on Karen's mind. Is it your sister? Claire asked. At their previous week's breakfast, Karen had told them about Victoria's situation.
Yeah, guys, I want to throttle her. Her husband punches her in the face. First, she won't let me call the police. And now she's acting like it was all a big mistake.
Liz frowned thoughtfully. She wants to put the whole thing behind her, right?
Yes, but it's more than that. She's embarrassed she even phoned me.
This isn't the first time Rogers hit her, is it? The question came from Claire. Karen couldn't be sure, but she guessed this was a pattern between Victoria and her husband. Abuse, followed by apologies and promises. Julia shook her head as though she found it difficult to comprehend how any woman would endure such treatment from her husband.
You weren't able to convince her to file a police report?
Not for lack of trying. Karen had done everything but make the call herself. She talked to her sister about contacting the authorities, calling her doctor, visiting a woman's crisis center, taking some kind of action. But Victoria wavered, and then later refused to discuss it.
It was all her fault, right? Claire said. That's what she told you, isn't it?
Karen nodded. That's exactly what Victoria said.
If she'd had Bryce in bed when Roger returned from his client dinner, everything would have been okay.
Can you believe it?
I'm afraid that sort of confused thinking is typical of abused women. Karen's frustration and anger were consuming her.
What can I do?
You can't talk to your parents? Julia asked. Karen had considered that herself, and after careful thought, recognized that it would only cause more problems within the family. In Victoria's current state of mind, she might deny the entire incident and then hate Karen for breaking her confidence. The same went for contacting social services. Roger would be furious, and Karen was convinced he'd take it out on Victoria.
You could suggest Victoria get some counseling, Claire advised.
Talking out my feelings with a counselor after Michael left helped me tremendously.
Speaking of Michael, how is he?
Karen asked, anxious now to change the subject. Claire pulled her scone apart, turning it into a pile of crumbs. He's finished with the second round of chemotherapy. I always thought I wanted to see him suffer. And now that he is, you're finding it difficult to watch? Liz murmured. Claire nodded.
Is the girlfriend around?
Karen wondered whether Michael was getting any support, emotional or otherwise, from Miranda Armstrong. Shrugging, Claire reached for her espresso. I wouldn't know.
How's Mick dealing with this?
Claire's sigh said it all. Not well. He isn't speaking to his father or Alex. And he's infuriated with me. He said we're the most screwed-up family he's ever known, and wants nothing to do with us.
He doesn't mean it. Karen rushed to assure her friend. I'm always saying stuff like that to my parents.
Oh, I mean it at the time, but I regret it later.
How's life treating you?
Julia asked, looking at Liz.
No complaints.
Have you run into Dr. Jameson lately? Claire wanted to know. For all her bitterness over her failed marriage, Claire was something of a romantic, Karen thought.
No,
Liz said abruptly.
He's been at the hospital, though, hasn't he?
I wouldn't know. She focused her gaze across the room, refusing to meet their eyes. Sean and I have agreed to disagree. End of side two.
Is that regret I'm seeing in you?
Julia asked softly. Liz considered her question for a long moment.
Perhaps.
But it's been 6 years since Steve was killed. In that time, I've learned I don't need a man in my life. If and when I decide to become involved, it'll be with a man who appreciates and respects me.
Karen leaned closer. You might not need a man, but that's not the same as wanting one.
Liz would make a great poker player, Karen decided. Her face was unreadable.
Maybe I'll get serious about dating, she said.
But Karen couldn't tell if she meant it or not.
You need to start dating, too, Julia said, staring at Claire.
At the shocked look that descended on Claire's face, they all burst into laughter.
You're joking, right?
No, I'm not, Julia insisted.
In fact, I have an uncle I want you to meet.
Claire's mouth opened and then closed, but no sound came out. Finally she asked,
Who?
My Uncle Leslie. He's gorgeous and fun and visiting the family. We're having him to dinner Saturday night, and I want you to join us. This is totally non-threatening. He's only going to be in town for a couple of weeks. He's divorced, too. He understands. You'll come, won't you? Julia pleaded. Claire looked uncertain and then seemed to arrive at a decision.
Yes, I think I will.
Liz positively beamed.
Are you sure you're up to this?
Claire asked Julia.
Entertaining and all?
Of course I am. The pregnancy's going okay? She nodded. But Karen noted a small hesitation.
I haven't been sick all week, but the last few days have been a real strain.
Adam and Zoe are barely speaking to Peter and me, and I've had to close the shop several times to run to Dr. Fisk's for my appointment. I hate closing it for even an hour.
Has the baby moved yet? Claire asked.
She's moving all the time.
She?
I don't know, but I like to think I'm having a girl. I have a name for her, Karen said. You should call her Thursday.
Thursday?
Sure. Why not? You could name her after us. From the diary of Claire Craig, April 7th. I can't believe I actually agreed to this dinner party. It's insane. The last time I went out with a man other than Michael was nearly 26 years ago. The minute Julia suggested the idea, I should have refused. I have no idea what made me agree. How could I have done such a thing without thinking it through more carefully? I'm not ready to date yet. I'm terrified of making myself vulnerable again. I don't want to put myself at risk, especially when I know how crippling the pain of rejection can be. But if I phone now, just hours before I'm supposed to show up, I'd be putting Julia on the spot. To be honest, I'm not as worried about that as I am about what she'd tell the others in our group. Then everyone would know what a coward I am. Okay, the decision is made. I'm going. I'll go with a brave smile and zero expectations. I have something to prove to myself. I am healing. Slowly but surely, I'm recovering from the grief of Michael's betrayal. I'm almost whole again. Julia reached for her hand when Claire arrived, giving her fingers a brief squeeze. Claire, you look wonderful. She should, Claire mused, seeing the time and effort that had gone into her appearance. She'd chosen a velvet cocktail suit in deep green with a silk camisole, after trying on every party outfit she owned. Julia led her into the family room where Peter sat talking to a distinguished-looking older man. Zoe and Adam were conspicuously absent. Julia had mentioned earlier that the children were out with friends. Claire, this is my uncle, Leslie Carter. Claire stepped forward, her hand outstretched. I'm delighted to meet you. Leslie Carter was a handsome man, just as Julia had promised. He had clear blue eyes and was beautifully tanned. He'd gone almost completely bald, but it was extremely attractive on him. Sexy in a Sean Connery way, Claire thought. She guessed he was somewhere in his late 50s, perhaps early 60s. They all sat down on the two comfortable sofas in the family room. Julia placed a dish of baked artichoke dip and crackers on the coffee table in front of Claire. I understand you're visiting the area, Claire said. I retired a few years ago, Leslie explained. He's traveling around the world in his sailboat, Peter said enthusiastically. So far, I haven't gone any farther than the west coast of the United States, Leslie corrected. But you're going to Hawaii from here, right? That's the plan. Julia stood and headed into the kitchen. Is there anything I can do to help? Claire asked. Not a thing, Julia assured her. Go ahead and visit while I put the finishing touches on the salad. Let me help, Peter said, as if on cue. All at once, Claire and Leslie were alone. She nervously twirled the stem of the wine glass between her hands, while her mind raced with possible conversational gambits. I understand you were recently divorced, Leslie said. Actually, it's been a while. A little more than a year. You're divorced, too? He nodded. 5 years now. It was an adjustment at first. I was prepared to grow old with Barbara. But she... It seems we grew in different directions. She wanted a new life that didn't include me. Claire nodded. She sensed that the failure of his marriage had damaged this man, and that he was still recovering, just as she was. Julia entered the room again. The salad's ready. Leslie got to his feet. In case you weren't aware of it, my niece is an excellent cook. The salad was impressive, a rich mixture of greens topped with slices of fresh pear, crumbled blue cheese and walnuts, served with a raspberry vinaigrette. Julia, you have outdone yourself, Leslie said after the first bite. Claire agreed. This is fabulous. Julia beamed at their praise. After the salad, Julia brought a baked salmon and a scalloped potato dish to the table. Both were beautifully presented and delicious. Claire had always suspected that her friend possessed finely tuned domestic talents, but she'd never guessed Julia was this accomplished.
At 9:30, after coffee and dessert, Claire decided it was time to head home.
I should be leaving, too, Leslie said and stood with her.
After a round of farewells and thank yous, Leslie walked Claire to her car, which was parked behind his at the curb. The night was lovely and warm. The stars were out, and the scent of blooming lemon trees filled the air.
Thank you, Claire, he said as she unlocked her car.
Claire knew what he meant.
Thank you.
He grinned. They understood each other. Not only had the evening been pleasant, it had given them hope for the future. Not necessarily a future together, but with someone. Romance and male companionship weren't lost possibilities, Claire thought, as long as there were men like Leslie Carter.
Enjoy your adventures, she said as she slid into the car. I'd love to see you when you get back.
Same here. Leslie closed the door for her, then walked to his own vehicle. Claire drove home, feeling better about life than she had in, well, in years. 2 years, to be exact.
Sharon Kelso is here, Liz's secretary announced over the intercom. She's asked to speak to you and says it's important.
Liz sighed. Her afternoon was booked solid, but her secretary certainly knew that. If the head of the nurses' union sought an impromptu meeting, then it went without saying something was up. In all likelihood, it meant trouble.
Show her in.
Liz felt slightly sick to her stomach.
Although a strike had been averted, relations between the hospital and the nursing staff remained tense.
She stood as Sharon marched purposefully into her office.
Hello, Sharon. What can I do for you?
The head of the nurses' union paused to collect her thoughts before speaking.
I don't mean to be telling tales out of school, but one of our nurses is experiencing a problem with a certain visiting specialist.
Do you want to file a complaint?
That's an option we've considered.
Can you tell me what this is about?
It involves recent corrective actions taken by Dr. Sean Jameson.
Liz should have known it had to do with Sean. She could barely keep from groaning aloud.
At this point, the staff member involved and I prefer to handle the situation without the formality of filing a complaint. Once you hear what happened, you'll understand our hesitation.
The story that followed was short and to the point.
One of my staff made a small clerical error on one of the charts. It was caught almost immediately. But when Dr. Jameson learned about it, he blew a gasket. He was rude, belligerent, and unnecessarily harsh. We're not perfect. We can only do our best. No one deserves the kind of tongue-lashing Dr. Jameson gave her. It was humiliating and downright scathing, and furthermore, he yelled at her in front of other people. I simply can't allow such unprofessional behavior to go unreported.
Liz understood Sharon's dilemma. Knowing Sean, she could well imagine the scene. She was surprised she hadn't heard about it before now. Liz didn't blame him for his anger, but took issue with the manner in which he'd expressed it. Under normal circumstances, Sharon wouldn't hesitate to file a formal complaint. The reason she didn't was understood. The nurse had been in the wrong, and she didn't want documentation acknowledging her error.
You'll talk to Dr. Jameson?
I will, Liz promised, although it was the last thing she wanted. To this point, they'd managed to avoid each other. It wasn't difficult. Other than instances such as this, there was no reason for any contact. Sharon left then, and Liz considered how best to handle this situation. Sean might assume that her asking to speak to him was a convenient excuse to see him again. She shook her head in frustration. Getting involved with him, however briefly, was a mistake. She walked over to her desk and pushed the intercom button.
Sherry, leave a message for Dr. Jameson to stop by my office at his earliest convenience, would you?
Sean didn't keep her waiting long. That very evening, just as Liz was shutting down her computer for the night, Sean appeared at her door.
You wanted to talk to me?
He wore his usual cocky grin as he strolled casually into her office. This is a professional matter. Please sit down. His face was carefully neutral as he claimed the chair across from her.
This has to do with the Tucker baby, doesn't it?
Was a formal complaint made?
If so, I'm here to tell you the woman deserved everything I said. There's one thing I won't tolerate, and that's... Liz held up her hand, stopping him. A complaint wasn't filed. He indicated no relief. The woman deserved to have her wrist slapped. Her carelessness could have cost the Tucker baby his life. There are a lot of things I'm willing to put up with at this hospital. But sloppy record-keeping isn't one of them. He shrugged. When it comes to my patients, I'm like a wounded bear. I know that, and so do you. No one's faulting your skills or your commitment. Just my bedside manner? No. I'd say it's your nurse's station tactics that are causing the problems. He rubbed the back of his neck and expelled a low sigh. I probably did come down on her a little too hard. I was afraid I was going to lose the Tucker boy. I hadn't slept in over 30 hours. I'll say something to her in the morning. That'll smooth things over. You were up for 30 hours? That's not good for you or your patients. Sean glared at her. Don't tell me how to do my job, and I won't tell you how to do yours. Liz remained calm. You should learn how to deal with pressure by some method other than terrorizing staff. You need to find some kind of release. I know, but you won't cooperate. A week in bed with you would cure everything that ails me. And it'd probably do you good as well. Liz gasped. She couldn't help it. She wasn't sure if she should be furious or just plain insulted. I don't appreciate your making comments like that, Sean, she said in a stiff voice. Of course you don't. Why else would I make them? She stared at him and saw that he was smiling. And then she realized the truth in his words. All his provocative remarks about women were intended to get a rise out of her. Nothing more. He spoke again. As a matter of fact, I do have a way of relieving stress of the job. Oh? Liz wasn't ready for his rapid switch from provocative to serious. Have you got an hour or two? I'll show you what it is. She hesitated. Am I interrupting anything? No. Nothing that can't be put off until later, I suppose. Grab your things, then. Curious, she did as he asked, picking up her sweater and her purse. He held out his hand, and she took it. Tell me where we're going, she said as he led her outside to his Lexus and opened the passenger door. You'll find out in a few minutes. A few minutes turned into 20. He headed toward the freeway on-ramp, drove for several miles, then exited, ending up in a residential neighborhood that was unfamiliar to Liz. She noticed that the houses were middle class, with well-maintained yards. Sean eased to a stop in front of a corner house. Nothing distinguished it from any of the others. You're taking me to meet friends? She asked. My very best friends. My dear Liz, I'm about to show you what I do to release the tension in my life. He led her up the sidewalk and gently tapped on the door. Liz was certain no one could possibly hear his knock. Just when she was prepared to suggest there was no one home, the door opened. A large African-American woman stood there wearing a stern look. As soon as she saw Sean, she broke into a wide smile, her face brightening with pleasure. Dr. Sean, aren't you a sight for sore eyes? Come in, come in. Sean pressed his hand to the small of Liz's back and directed her into the large foyer. And Liz saw the babies. What would have been the living room was set up with 6 cribs and an equal number of rocking chairs. Each of the cribs held an infant, and most of them were crying. The woman eyed Liz curiously. Who'd you bring with you? Clarissa, this is my friend, Liz Kenyon. Liz, Clarissa Howard. Welcome to Little Lambs. These are all crack or heroin babies. Clarissa and her staff are here to love them through the worst of the withdrawals. Dr. Sean is our favorite physician, Clarissa told Liz, her gaze adoring. The babies love him too, isn't that right? Sean didn't answer. Instead, he walked over to the farthest crib. With a tenderness Liz had rarely seen in a man, Sean reached into the crib and lifted an emaciated infant and held him gently. This is Donovan. Only 3 weeks old, Sean whispered as he settled into the closest rocking chair. Poor little tyke. Came into this world facing one hell of an uphill climb.
Little Faye could do with being rocked, Clarissa said boldly, staring at Liz. She's over there.
Liz knew an order when she heard one. Smiling, she found the crib marked with Faye's name. She gathered the baby in her arms and sat in a rocker. The baby gazed up at her, eyes wet with tears, lower lip quivering.
Poor sweetheart, Liz whispered, gently brushing the curls from the baby's brow.
Clarissa took a third child and settled herself between Sean and Liz, humming quietly as she rocked, the baby cuddled in her loving arms. 30 minutes later, the room was quiet. Liz glanced over and realized that Sean's eyes were closed. Clarissa's gaze followed hers. He falls asleep nearly every time. It's amazing how rocking the babies calms him down.
Liz had to agree that was quite a switch.
He told me this is what he does to unwind.
Does he come often?
Quite a bit. But it's been a week or so since his last visit.
The man was full of surprises, thought Liz to herself. Do you love him?
Clarissa shocked her by asking next. She wasn't sure how to answer.
I don't know.
Someone should. He needs a woman, and you're the first one he's ever brought here. That lifted Liz's spirits. Clarissa went on.
Far as I'm concerned, there's no better man than Dr. Sean. He helped create little lambs, and he recommended me for the job. If he wanted me to walk over red-hot coals, I'd do it for him, without asking why.
A full hour passed before Sean woke. He yawned, looked in Liz's direction, and asked, "You ready to go?"
"Whenever you are."
He replaced a sleeping Donovan in the crib, and within a few minutes they were on the street, driving back to her house. Liz chanced to look in his direction. From what Clarissa had said, she was the first woman he'd ever brought to Little Lambs. What she didn't understand was, why? What did she actually mean to him? What did he really want from her?
"You're frowning," he said.
They'd stopped at a traffic light before heading onto the ramp that led to the freeway. He reached over and squeezed her hand, his fingers lingering in hers.
"Just thinking."
"Any thoughts you want to share with me?"
"One, I think there might be some hope for this relationship after all."
Sean gave no outward response for a moment. Then he said,
"That's what I've been trying to tell you. I don't know why you women don't listen to men more often."
Liz groaned and shook her head, but not before she saw him trying to suppress a laugh. She was smiling, too. Claire turned off the vacuum and heard the phone in the background as the Hoover moaned to a stop. Lunging for the cordless, she had no idea if this was the first ring or the fifth.
"Hello?" she said, slightly breathless.
Her greeting was met by a short hesitation.
"Claire, it's Michael."
"Alex is at school," she reminded him in case he'd forgotten.
"Actually, I wanted to talk to you. I'd like to invite you to lunch."
Michael shocked her by asking,
"Lunch?"
She nearly choked on the word.
"It's my way of thanking you for your kindness while I underwent chemo."
She fought the urge to accept. "I know you appreciated my help, Michael. But I don't believe our having lunch is the right thing to do. Not at this point in our lives."
There was a long pause.
"Actually, I need to talk to you."
"Talk to me now."
"I can't," he told her with what sounded like regret. "All I'm asking is that you meet me. Any place you want, any time." Her curiosity got the better of her.
"All right. Meet me at Mocha Moments at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon."
Claire hung up, wondering what the hell was so important that Michael had sought her out. Precisely at 3 the next day, Michael walked into Mocha Moments. He was even thinner than the last time she'd seen him, but not so horribly pale. Some of the color had returned to his cheeks. He paused just inside the door and smiled when he saw her.
"Hello, Claire."
"Hello, Michael." She inclined her head toward him, choosing not to study him too closely for fear he might misinterpret her interest. Pulling out a chair, he sat down across from her.
"How are you?"
she asked. Now that he was close, she realized he didn't look as good as she'd first assumed. The whites of his eyes had a yellowish tinge, and while there was color in his face, his cheeks were still gaunt.
"I'm better now, thanks."
"The cancer?" He didn't respond right away.
"I didn't come here to exchange news."
She felt a little hurt, a little insulted.
"Fine. Then get to the point and be done with it," she snapped.
"Actually, I have a favor to ask of you."
He had a funny way of leading up to it, she thought, considering he'd just antagonized her. She wasn't the one who'd asked for this meeting. Her being here was a favor to him.
"I don't have any right to ask this."
"I wouldn't, if it wasn't for our sons," Michael went on, his voice lower now.
"Ask me what?" She tried to temper the defensiveness she heard in her own voice. His eyes bored holes into hers.
"I want you to come back and work at the dealership."
She didn't need to think it over. Didn't need to hear the reasons. Her answer was instantaneous.
"No, no way."
Michael raised his hand.
"Let me explain. The entire future of Craig Chevrolet hangs on your answer. I need you to assume my role."
"And just where will you be?" If he told her he needed time to take Miranda on some exotic vacation, she'd tell him exactly what he could do with his job offer. He wouldn't look at her. He dragged a shaky breath through his lungs.
"I've been selected for an experimental drug treatment. It means I won't be able to continue my duties at the dealership."
"This has to do with the cancer?" Again, he wouldn't meet her gaze.
"You know the car business better than anyone. Despite our differences over the past few years, I trust you. The dealership is heavily mortgaged now, and unless this transition is smooth, I could lose everything."
He was afraid of losses. Claire was stunned by his insensitivity. She'd had her life ripped apart, her security shredded, her heart broken. Now he was afraid that if he spent a few weeks away from the business, it might falter. So he'd come to her. Yes, any erosion of the dealership's finances would have an impact on her and the boys. But to ask her to step in like this, as though they were still a married couple, still a team? Well, they weren't. And that was entirely his doing. She stood. "Hire Miranda, Michael, because I'm not interested." She turned to leave, but his hand on her arm stopped her.
"Miranda left me."
The pain behind those words was barely concealed. Claire felt her knees buckle. For 2 years, she'd wanted him to experience just a fraction of the emotional agony she'd endured when he'd walked out on her. Now she found it difficult to look at the pain in his eyes. Michael was alone, and knew what it was like to come home to a cold, empty house.
"When did she leave?" "A while ago now. Actually, she moved in with a friend soon after I learned about the cancer. She has trouble dealing with sickness."
She studied him for any signs of regret and saw none. Even now, sick and abandoned by the woman he'd given up so much for, he revealed no contrition, despite what he'd done to Claire and their family. That hurt, and she silently chastised herself for seeking more than he could give. He straightened, staring at her.
"Will you do it? Will you take over for me when I go into the hospital?"
Claire couldn't meet his eyes.
"I need time to think about it." "Damn it, Claire, I don't have time. Can't you see? Do I have to spell it out for you? I'm dying. According to the specialists, I'll be lucky if this treatment buys me 6 more months. Now, are you going to help me or not?"
"Your father and I would like you to join us for lunch next Saturday,"
Catherine Curtis informed Karen in her most prim voice. She used the tone guaranteed to set Karen's teeth on edge every time. Karen knew it wasn't her company they sought, or at least her mother didn't. Something was up, and she suspected she wasn't going to like it. "Any reason you and Dad want to talk to me?" Karen asked. "Better to get a heads-up now than be blindsided later."
"Can't your father and I invite you to the house without a reason?"
her mother asked with a light, twinkling laugh, a laugh that was so forced Karen had to cringe. "You always have a reason, Mother. I want to know why you want me there."
"Because I asked it of you.
Let's not get into this now. I'll look forward to seeing you at noon on Saturday."
"Yes, Mother,"
Karen muttered, banging down the telephone receiver. Saturday arrived far too soon, long before Karen was ready. By the time she arrived at her parents' house, her stomach was swarming with nerves. She knew from experience that her mother was likely to serve a 5-course meal, and Karen didn't have the appetite to enjoy even one bite. The first thing she noticed when she pulled into the circular driveway in front of her parents' home was that Victoria's car wasn't there. Always before, her sister had been included in these lunches. Not today, which led to immediate speculation that this conversation had something to do with her sister. Before she could change her mind, Karen parked her 10-year-old Ford Tempo. The front door opened, and her mother stood in the entrance. Karen's engine was still hacking and coughing, even though the ignition had been turned off. Her mother started to say something, but seemed to think better of it and turned away. Karen followed her into the kitchen, then glanced around expecting to find her father somewhere. "Where's Dad?"
"He sends his apologies, but he was called into the office."
"On a Saturday?" Karen clasped her hands to conceal any signs of nervousness. She'd hoped her father would be here. If Victoria wasn't around, her father could have served as a buffer. Catherine opened the refrigerator and removed a sesame chicken and pasta salad. Bread steaming from the oven was already out on the kitchen table.
"Shall we sit down?" Catherine said.
"Sure." Karen slid into her chair and unfolded her linen napkin. Catherine handed her the chicken salad. The warm bread followed. Karen took her first bite, but it seemed to get stuck in the back of her throat. She knew it would be impossible to down another forkful until she learned what this was all about.
"Just tell me."
Her mother's eyes widened.
"Tell you what, dear?"
"Why you invited me here." Her mother sighed. To Karen's surprise, she capitulated without any more of that conversational thrust and parry. "I'm concerned about Victoria," she said in a flat voice. She knew. Thank God. Somehow her mother had learned that Roger was beating Victoria. Relief swept through Karen. Surely her mother would step in now and help in ways that she couldn't.
"I'm worried about her, too. We need to do something, Mom."
"Yes, well, has she opened up to you?"
"She called me a few months ago, absolutely desperate. I was deathly afraid of what Roger might do."
Her mother frowned.
"Victoria phoned you?"
"I'm sure she would have called you and Dad, but she didn't want to alarm you."
"How do you find out? Did you see the bruises?"
"She's gotten so good at hiding them. It's more than the physical abuse. It's the horrible things Roger says to her. The worst part is that she believes them."
Her mother went pale, and her hand crept to her throat.
Karen hesitated.
"Are you all right?"
A sick feeling came over her, and she realized she'd made a serious mistake in assuming that Victoria had confided in her parents.
"You didn't know, did you?"
Her mother's hand trembled as she reached for her iced tea.
"I've known for some weeks that things weren't right between Victoria and Roger, but I didn't want to interfere."
She shook her head.
"I thought Victoria seemed depressed. That's what worried me. That's what I'd hoped to discuss with you."
"Roger hits her?" Karen nodded. "Is he abusing Bryce?"
"No, not to my knowledge."
Catherine gave up all pretense of eating.
"This is far worse than I imagined. Dear God, why couldn't she tell me?"
"I'm sure Victoria wanted to, but she doesn't know how. She's embarrassed and ashamed. Everyone assumes Victoria has the perfect marriage, and she didn't want to disillusion any of us.
But why would she allow this kind of treatment to continue?
Mom, the whys don't matter. We can sort all that out later. Right now, we both need to concentrate on how to help Victoria. She's at the point where she can't do it for herself.
Her mother stared down at her lunch plate.
What are we going to do?
I don't know. I wanted her to leave the jerk, but Victoria wouldn't hear of it, nor will she involve the police.
We must consider our options very carefully.
Karen, let's give this some more thought. Karen relaxed in her chair for the first time since she'd arrived. The burden of Victoria's life was lifted from her shoulders. She and her mother were allies, united in the quest to help her sister. She felt 100 times better. She shoved her plate away and leaned her elbows on the table.
Okay, Mom, let's get to work.
Thursday morning breakfast club. Liz, by nature, was prompt, and thus the first to arrive at Mocha Moments. She ordered her croissant and coffee, and secured the table by the window so she could watch for her friends. Claire arrived soon afterward, looking harried. The last 2 Thursdays, she'd only stayed about 10 minutes before rushing off to the dealership. Earlier in the week, Liz had left a message with Alex, but Claire hadn't called her back.
Morning,
Claire said, carrying her espresso and scone to the table. She was about to sit down, but stopped in mid-action.
I never did return your call, did I?
No.
Damn, I'm sorry. It's just that I've been running around like a lunatic for the last couple of weeks.
She sank into her seat. I noticed, Liz said, without chastisement.
Hello, everyone.
Julia pulled out her usual chair and joined them. The maternity jumper seemed new, and Liz was pleased to see some color in her cheeks.
How was your week?
She asked them both.
Before they could answer, Karen appeared. Sorry I'm late.
She greeted them with her cheerful smile as she bounced into her seat. This week's latte was plunked down on the table, and some of it sloshed out of the cup. Liz wondered what flavor combination she'd selected today.
How is everyone? Karen asked.
I'm feeling great, Liz said, and she meant it. She smiled widely. Happiness seemed to radiate from her.
So speaks a woman in love.
Julia poured her brewed herbal tea into her mug.
In love?
Karen raised her voice in excitement.
You're falling for that doctor friend of yours, aren't you?
The operative word here is friend. Sean and I are just friends. Claire eyed her skeptically.
Nothing more?
Nothing more, Liz quickly agreed, and she was serious. Sean wanted her in his bed, but he'd accepted her refusal with unexpected grace. As a result, their friendship had flourished, deepening beyond work talk and casual conversation.
Yeah, right, Karen muttered, not bothering to conceal her disbelief.
The way you feel about him is written all over you.
Help me, please, Claire moaned. My friend is falling in love and she can't think straight.
Cut it out, Liz returned sternly, but was unable to keep back a smile. She was in love, and it felt absolutely wonderful.
Love can have consequences,
Julia said, placing her hands over the small mound that was her baby.
Before you ask, everything's developing nicely.
I'm nearly 7 months along now.
I guess I spent so long trying to deny that I was pregnant, the weeks just slipped away.
What about Adam and Zoe? Have they had an attitude adjustment yet? Liz asked.
Julia shook her head. Most of the time, they're still angry and upset with Peter and me, as though we purposely set out to destroy their self-involved little lives.
That's one of the reasons we don't talk much about the baby around them.
It's fairly obvious you're pregnant, Claire said.
It isn't like they can ignore it.
Yes, they can, Julia insisted, and they are. And to complicate everything even more, Peter and I still don't know what we're going to do about daycare.
I thought you said Peter could get 3 months paid leave after the baby's born, and that he'd bring him or her to you at the store for feedings.
But that's only 3 months, and I don't even know how well it's going to work.
You can't keep the baby at the store.
Not if I intend to give good customer service. I think people would be tolerant for a little while, but not on an everyday basis. It is, after all, a retail store.
Liz agreed with her. It's one thing with an infant. You might be able to manage. But when he or she begins to crawl, I don't know what I'm going to do. Julia murmured again, eyes disconsolate. I might have to close the shop. I'd hate that, and it would make me resent my baby, which I don't want. But I don't want to throw away all my hard work, either. She shrugged helplessly. The baby has to be my first priority. There don't seem to be any easy answers, do there? Claire's voice revealed her sympathy. None, and the crazy part is, I'm actually looking forward to having this baby. After all the angst and doubt I had in the beginning, I didn't think that was possible. Now, if only my children would develop some tolerance. Adam and Zoe will come around, Karen said. Just be patient.
6 months of substitute teaching, and the girl's an expert on child rearing, Claire muttered under her breath.
Hey, Karen countered. I spend 8 to 10 hours a day, 4 days a week dealing with teenagers. I know how they think. Liz was surprised. You must be substituting a lot more hours than you were before.
I've been filling in at Manchester High School.
Isn't that where the chemistry teacher works? Liz asked. The one you hooked up with? Karen lowered her gaze.
Yeah.
Liz read the signs like a skilled scout. You like this guy.
I do. Glenn is wonderful.
And the classes I'm teaching have been pretty wonderful, too. Guess what I've been teaching?
English?
No. Drum roll, please. Drama classes. Guys, I absolutely love it.
Drama? Liz repeated.
Karen, that's great.
How's your sister doing? Claire asked next. Karen didn't say anything right away. And it seemed to Liz that she struggled to answer.
Okay, I guess. She isn't speaking to me at the moment. Every time I call her, she hangs up on me.
Why? If Claire had been able to stay for more than 10 minutes the last couple of weeks, she'd know. Karen had told them about the lunch with her mother, and how she'd inadvertently blurted out the truth about Victoria's marriage. Her mother had then confronted Victoria, and Karen's older sister had resented the intrusion. Soon afterward, the two sisters had an angry exchange. In the end, Victoria had slammed the door in Karen's face, but not before she'd screamed that she wanted nothing more to do with her. Karen frowned darkly.
I refuse to give up on her, though. I'm stopping by her place this afternoon. She won't have any choice but to talk to me then.
Good, Julia said. How did Alex's graduation go this weekend? Liz asked Claire. A moment's hesitation was followed by, good. From the flat way she spoke, Liz knew something was wrong. So did the others, because everyone stopped to look at Claire.
You'd better tell us what happened, Liz said.
Claire exhaled noisily.
Michael insisted on attending the graduation.
Liz frowned. He's been hospitalized all week.
I know.
Alex said he wanted him at the ceremony if possible. And then Michael said he wasn't going to let his son down.
How'd he get there?
Taxi.
He wouldn't ask me because we'd had an argument about the dealership.
He's constantly checking up on me, and it was driving me nuts. I know I was being unfair and unreasonable, but I let Michael have it.
She paused and dragged in a deep breath.
Alex didn't say that Michael was going. He couldn't. He was afraid that Mick wouldn't show up if he learned his father planned to be there. He was probably right, too.
How come you saw each other? Julia asked.
Assigned seating. Each family was allowed 3 tickets, and all 3 of ours were together.
Oh, dear, Karen whispered.
Michael looks dreadful.
Just dreadful.
Mick was shocked. At first, he tried to pretend Michael wasn't there. Later, I glanced over, and I could tell Mick was having a hard time seeing his father again, especially in this condition.
How bad is he? Liz asked. Almost afraid of the answer.
Bad. Really bad. He's down over 50 pounds now, and his skin is this sickly yellow color.
Claire pinched her lips together.
He's dying. He told me he was. But I don't think I actually believed it. I guess I couldn't bring myself to accept it.
Now there's no denying it, is there?
Julia reached across the table and placed her hand on her friend's. Liz placed her hand on top of Julia's, And Karen set her own hand over all of theirs.
Did Mick and Michael talk?
Karen asked.
Not at first.
It was as if they were invisible to each other. Then the graduates entered the auditorium, and everyone stood as Pomp and Circumstance was played. Mick and I stood, and Michael tried to.
He fell?
Tears rolled down Claire's face.
No. Mick caught him and helped him back into his chair. The next thing I knew, they were both weeping and clinging to each other.
She half sobbed, half laughed, as she said, "It was quite a display for the rest of the audience. And some of them were crying, too."
"Is Michael back in the hospital now?"
Liz asked quietly.
Claire didn't answer immediately.
"He's with us."
"With you?"
Karen repeated.
"He can't go back to the rental house. At this point, he's incapable of living on his own."
"So he's living with the boys and me." She bit her lip hard, leaving tooth marks.
"He's come home to die."
From the diary of Julia Murchison.
"July 4th. I slept in late this morning, and while Peter and the kids are out picking up some last-minute supplies for the barbecue, I'm taking an hour for myself. After a long soak in the tub, I decided to write in my journal. The last time I did that was a week ago. I can hardly believe 7 days have passed. Usually I write every morning, but my body seems to require more sleep lately. And when the alarm rings, I just can't drag myself out of bed. Peter feels that if I'm in need of extra sleep, I should take it. I do, but then the morning's one mad rush, and my day's completely off kilter. This pregnancy is completely different from my previous two. At first I assumed it was because I'm 14 years older and my body knows it. I suspect there's more to it, though. The fact that I'm 40 explains some of the differences, but not all of them. However, Dr. Fisk keeps telling me that every pregnancy is unique. Maybe this is just going to be a more difficult baby. That's certainly been the case so far. At least my fears that there's something wrong with the baby have been calmed now that all the test results are in. I thank God we're going to have a healthy child. Today is going to be fun. Peter and the kids and I are having a barbecue, and then afterwards we're all heading over to the pier to watch the fireworks. Adam and Zoe will probably meet up with their friends before then, and everyone will rendezvous back at the house at 10:30 for banana splits, a family 4th of July tradition. Today, I refuse to worry. I refuse to give 1 minute's thought to the lack of daycare arrangements for this unborn child. I refuse to feel upset about Adam and Zoe's selfishness. I intend to sit with my feet up and enjoy the sunshine, appreciate my family, and salute my country. That's quite a manifesto for one day. But I plan to do everything within my power to make it happen. Peter stood, hands on his hips, in front of Julia's lounge chair.
"Don't you look comfortable?"
Shading her eyes, Julia glanced up. She smiled, reveling in the late morning sunshine.
"I am in hog heaven." Julia rarely had an opportunity to indulge herself like this, to actually lie in the sun and do nothing.
It was an interlude she cherished all the more for its brevity. Everything for the barbecue was in the refrigerator, including 3 different salads. For the first time in her married life, she was about to serve deli-made potato salad to her family. Adam was sure to complain about that, and he could go right ahead. If he wanted to peel potatoes for an hour, then more power to him. Adam came onto the patio and slumped into the chair next to Julia.
"I'm hungry," Adam muttered.
"So what else is new?"
Zoe called from the house,
"Mom, should I bring out the cheese dip?"
She twisted around.
All right, you can bring out the goodies."
Adam rushed into the house to help his sister. Peter took the lounge chair he'd abandoned.
"This is the life."
He lay back with a long sigh and smiled into the sun. This story is continued on the other side of the cassette.
"What's this?"
Adam demanded, reemerging with a plastic-coated, nut-crusted cheese ball. Julia looked up.
"What does it look like?"
"What happened to the one you always make?"
"I didn't make it this year."
"But..."
Peter cut him off.
Adam, your mother's pregnant, and she doesn't need to be standing on her feet all day cooking for the rest of us.
Adam exploded.
Everything doesn't have to change because Mom was dumb enough to get pregnant. Nothing's the same anymore, and I hate it. She used to be a real person, and now all she is pregnant.
He pitched the cheese ball at the lawn and stormed back into the house. Zoe walked out onto the patio. I can understand why he's so upset. He would have had a car if it wasn't for... She angled her head toward Julia's abdomen. There was no guarantee of that, Julia argued. She'd heard all this countless times. Can we talk about something else, please?
Like what?
Zoe asked.
What about names for the baby?
Peter suggested cheerfully. Zoe stamped her foot.
The baby's all anyone wants to talk about, Zoe cried. It's the baby this and the baby that. If Mom's sick of Adam wanting his own car, then I can be sick of this baby.
She raced back into the house and slammed the sliding glass door so hard it bounced and slid partway open again. Peter shook his head.
I don't think I've ever been more disappointed in my children, he muttered.
But Julia wasn't going to let either of her children ruin her stress-free, worry-free holiday. I'm ignoring them both and suggest you do likewise. She settled back in the lounger and closed her eyes. That was when she felt a sudden, inexplicable pain. She froze for a moment, then placed her hands on her stomach. It wasn't the onset of labor. That she would have recognized. Something's wrong. She choked out the words, holding her abdomen tightly, nearly blinded by the pain. Julia, what is it? Julia heard her husband, but couldn't answer. Suddenly, she felt liquid gush from between her legs. At first, she assumed her water had broken. Then she saw the blood and nearly fainted.
Blood! Oh, my God! There's blood everywhere!
Peter was at her side almost immediately, his face pale.
What's happening?
Julia cried, clinging to his arms.
What's wrong?
I don't know. We need to get you to the hospital.
It's the baby. The baby's in trouble.
The panic was rising in Julia. She saw it reflected in the face of her husband. Peter looked wild-eyed as he tried to comfort her. The next few minutes were a blur until Julia heard the sound of the emergency siren. The paramedics, directed by Peter, came through the gate into the backyard. Two young men lifted Julia from the lounger and placed her on a stretcher.
Mom! Mom!
Zoe was weeping and nearly hysterical. She grabbed her mother's hand.
What's wrong? Tell me what's wrong.
I don't know, honey. I don't know. Everything's going to be all right, Peter assured his children. But his words rang false. The paramedics carried the stretcher toward the waiting ambulance. The blood continued to gush from between Julia's legs. So much blood, such intense pain, and a fear so paralyzing Julia could barely think. Everything will be fine in a few minutes, Peter told her, holding tightly onto her fingers. She clutched his hand hard. She could feel herself weakening.
Call Liz,
she pleaded, certain she was about to pass out. As the hospital administrator, Liz could ensure Peter and the children would be kept informed of her condition.
Liz?
Kenyon, Julia whispered, fighting off unconsciousness.
Thursday's at 8.
The next time she opened her eyes, she realized she was at the hospital. Although it took a tremendous effort, she tried to lever herself up on one elbow to see who was in the room. The nurse who stood beside her pressed a gentle hand to Julia's shoulder.
Mrs. Murchison? My husband. I want my husband.
You'll see him soon, okay? Julia couldn't imagine where Peter would be. She needed him. She wanted him with her.
What's happening to my baby?
You're at Willow Grove Memorial Hospital. Your placenta has ripped away from the uterus. We've called in Dr. Fisk, and as soon as he arrives, we'll be taking the baby by cesarean section.
It's too early.
She wasn't quite 7 months pregnant. Don't you worry. We have one of the finest preemie doctors in the state.
Dr. Jameson?
Julia asked, remembering what Liz had told her about Sean Jameson.
Yes. He's already on his way. Everything will be fine.
Thank you, Julia whispered, her voice thick and a bit slurred. She sincerely hoped the nurse knew what she was talking about. Sean had found a premium parking spot at the beach. Liz could hardly believe their good fortune.
The sky was the purest shade of blue, and the sun, as always, shone bright along the California shoreline. A refreshing breeze blew off the water. A perfect 4th of July. They'd spent the morning at Little Lamb's. They visited with each one of the babies, and Liz was delighted to see that little Faye showed some improvement. As they were about to leave, Clarissa had pulled her to one side.
"I see you have your answer," the other woman whispered.
Liz hadn't immediately made the connection. Then she recalled Clarissa's question during the first visit and understood.
"Do you love him?"
she had asked. Liz didn't respond, merely nodded.
"Good for you,"
Clarissa said, chuckling to herself as she let them out the front door. From Little Lambs, they drove to the beach. Liz was happier than she could remember being in a long time. Neither of them needed a course set for this relationship. Not at this stage of their lives. For now, Liz was content to have someone special to share the small, everyday things. A companion, a friend, maybe, in time, a lover. Someone who loved and appreciated the woman she was. Liz hoped for the opportunity to play that role in Sean's life as well. They were strolling, hand in hand, along the crowded sidewalk when Sean's beeper went off. Liz knew the sound all too well. Earlier, he'd warned her that he was on call, and the beeper meant that her 4th of July was about to be interrupted. When he read the message on his pager, Liz's cell phone rang inside her purse. So few people had the number that she knew it must be important. Liz felt around until she found her phone and flipped it open on the third ring. "Hello? Is this Liz Kenyon?" Peter Murchison introduced himself and explained the circumstances. "I'm leaving now," she told him, then snapped the phone closed and dumped it back into her purse. Sean waited for her.
"I've got to get to..."
"I know. The Murchison baby's mother is a good friend of mine. That was her husband. Julia asked if I'd come to the hospital."
"Let's go."
As they headed toward the hospital, Liz reached for her cell phone again. She hit the on button and saw Sean giving her a puzzled look.
"Who are you calling?"
"The rest of the Thursday morning breakfast group."
"Why?
You aren't Julia's family."
"No, we're her friends. And this baby is important to us.
We were there when she found out she was pregnant. We watched her deal with family, friends, even her customers' reactions. And we're going to stand by her now."
"Must be a woman thing," he muttered.
"If I needed emergency surgery, my golfing buddies wouldn't parade over to the hospital and sit there worrying about me."
"I would."
He turned to stare at her and nearly ran a red light. Liz screamed as he entered the intersection. He slammed on the brakes, and Liz vaulted forward, the seatbelt cutting into her shoulder. Her phone flew onto the dash.
"Damn it, Liz, you can't go saying things like that when I'm driving."
"Things like what?" He frowned at her, and she couldn't imagine why.
"Never mind."
She shook her head and retrieved her phone to resume her calling. By the time Liz and Sean arrived at the hospital, Julia had delivered a baby boy, weighing in at 2 pounds, 10 ounces. Sean went to assess baby Murchison's situation, while Liz made her way to the waiting area. The room was full of people who milled around, most of them pacing restlessly, talking in low, anxious voices. She introduced herself.
"I have a brother," Adam said, beaming proudly as he repeatedly shook Liz's hand.
Was this really the same boy who'd given his parents nothing but grief from the moment he learned Julia was pregnant? Right now, he seemed pleased and excited. Liz hoped his enthusiasm lasted.
"Dad said we're going to name him Zachary Justin,"
Zoe said, and impulsively hugged Liz.
"Mom talks about you all the time," she whispered.
This was Zoe, who did nothing but complain how embarrassed she was about the pregnancy.
"I think your mother's wonderful," Liz told her. "She's very proud of you and your brother."
Zoe's eyes filled with tears.
"I think my mom's wonderful, too."
Claire arrived 10 minutes after Liz, with Karen following a half hour later. The three of them stood in one corner, talking quietly, while Peter, the kids, and Julia's family settled in another section of the room. Every now and again they'd exchange comments or questions. At about 4:30, Peter was summoned by a nurse, apparently for a conference with Sean. Tension in the room increased perceptibly until he returned.
"According to Dr. Jameson, Zachary's chances of survival are very good."
Peter paused, then continued in a steady voice.
About 90% of infants born weighing less than 3 pounds survive.
90%? The odds sounded good to Liz, who felt a giddy sense of relief.
Just a minute. Peter held up his hand and silenced the group. Before we start celebrating, we need to recognize that there could still be problems. Dr. Jameson said there's no guarantee Zachary won't develop any number of other complications.
Such as?
Cerebral palsy. There's also a real fear that Zach could develop chronic respiratory problems.
When will we know?
Not for some time. Peter's face was bleak, and he slumped into a chair. This is only the beginning. Of course, he might escape at all. But as of right now, there's no way of telling.
How's Julia? Claire asked.
Julia's resting. Naturally, she's worried about Zachary. Zach might die?
Adam asked, as though the information was just now beginning to sink in.
Yes.
I want to see him,
Zoe pleaded. Her voice was shaky.
He's my baby brother.
You can't now, Peter said, as he wrapped his arms around his two older children. But I'll do everything I can to make sure you get to.
From the diary of Karen Curtis, August 1st. I spent the entire day on a shoot. This commercial has the potential to get me a bit role on a sitcom, and I should be thrilled. Normally I would be, but so much is happening. I'm beginning to wonder if my head's screwed on straight. Glenn's been on my mind a lot. I can't believe I'm falling for a chemistry teacher. A brain. But he's so much fun and so level-headed and just all around wonderful. Last week he casually mentioned that the high school has an opening for a full-time drama teacher. That was all he said. He didn't urge me to apply, didn't give me any of the details, but he knew. He had to know. The most fun I've had all year was the few days I filled in for the drama teacher. That includes everything else I've done, even the hairspray commercial that was shown nationally. Even the times Glenn and I have gone out. I absolutely loved teaching that class. Last week, when Gwen called me to audition for a bit role in Tom, Dick, and Harriet, a pilot for situation comedy, I hesitated. Normally, I would have leaped at the chance. I hemmed and hawed until my agent asked if I actually wanted this audition, because she had 30 other clients who'd die for the opportunity. I told her I wanted it, but I don't know if that's true anymore. I'm finally close to the goal I've been after for 10 years, and I'm on the verge of saying no to it all. I wish to hell I could figure out what's wrong with me. Perhaps it's all the worry about Victoria, who still isn't speaking to me. My sister's attitude has really got me down. I've tried to explain, but the minute she recognizes my voice, she hangs up the phone. I went to her house, but she wouldn't answer the door. Fine, whatever. If that's the way she wants to be, then it's her loss. I've done everything I can to repair our relationship. It isn't just the falling out with Victoria that's bothering me, or the job dilemma. The breakfast group is deeply involved with Julia and her baby. Little Zachary isn't responding as well as Dr. Jameson would like. It's tearing poor Julia apart. She's spending as much time as she can at the hospital. When she isn't with the baby, then Peter is. Julia's mother is retired now, and thankfully, she's filling in at the shop. Adam and Zoe finally came around. After months of claiming they wanted nothing to do with this baby, they're helping out at home and at Julia's shop, doing whatever they can. They've been incredibly helpful these last 3 weeks. The situation is so intense. We all know it can go either way with Zachary. He might be all right. He might end up disabled. If he lives, Julia's in agony over it and blames herself, which makes no sense. We tell her repeatedly that she did everything she could, but she doesn't listen. She's going through this terrible guilt. If she'd eaten better, rested more, tried to do less, everyone understands how she feels, although we know none of it is true. Dr. Jameson has been wonderful. I remember when Liz first started seeing him and what a jerk we all thought he was. Our opinion of him has taken a 180-degree turn. He's been so kind to Julia and Peter, answering their questions, spending time with them. He hasn't minimized the dangers of Zachary's situation. And although it's painful, I know Julia wants the truth. I never realized how strongly I'd feel about Julia's baby. My admiration for her grows all the time.
In some ways, she's stronger than the rest of us put together. When she first discovered she was pregnant, I expected her to quickly terminate the pregnancy. I wanted to ask her why she didn't, especially when it became clear what an inconvenience the baby was going to be in all their lives. We would have understood, and we certainly wouldn't have judged her, but she didn't do it. Julia has taught me so much about inner strength and conviction. Even now, when the outcome with Zachary remains so uncertain, in my heart of hearts, I feel she did the right thing. What with my own career, or lack thereof, my sister's problem and Julia's baby, I feel emotionally drained. This heat isn't helping, either. It's miserable. And just now, that's the way my whole life feels. From the diary of Julia Murchison, August 24th. The last time I wrote in my journal was the morning of Zachary's birth. It's hard to believe that was nearly 2 months ago. From the moment he was born, everything in our lives has been centered on him. I'll be heading out to the hospital soon, since I try to get there by 8 every morning. I used to worry about the shop. I'd get into a state if I had to close an hour early, certain I was losing a sale. In the last 2 months, I've barely given my fledgling business a thought. Thankfully, my mother has been filling in for me. I realize this isn't a permanent solution, but she claims she's enjoying herself. It's one less thing to worry about. Mom's fully retired now, and she loves to knit as much as I do. She came to me recently and suggested she continue working half days after Zachary's home. Then in the afternoon, we can trade places, and I'll work while she stays with the baby. I haven't talked to Peter about it yet, but the suggestion sounds ideal to me. Mom isn't the only person wanting to care for Zach. Amazingly enough, Adam and Zoe, too. They have been wonderful, and I'm grateful for that, too. Adam has shown a level of maturity I hadn't seen in him before. Maturity, and a willingness to help in any way he can. Luckily, since he has his driver's license, he can take Zoe to her tennis lessons and run other necessary errands. He's chauffeured me to the hospital every afternoon, and we've had more time to talk one-on-one than we have in years. Zoe's been a great help all summer, too. She's taken it upon herself to cook dinners and take care of the laundry. I haven't had the time or inclination for housework. When I get home from the hospital, it's late, and I'm exhausted and emotionally drained. Without my having to ask her, Zoe took over. Peter, my wonderful, wonderful husband. I've never loved him more than I have in the last 2 months. Whenever I get discouraged about Zachary's condition, he finds a way to raise my spirits. He refuses to allow me to give up or worry about the expense. I don't have any idea what the hospital or doctor bills will be, or how much will be covered by our insurance. It's frightening to think about. Frankly, I don't care if we end up going bankrupt. I want my son to live and to grow up a normal and happy child. Looking at him now, seeing the tubes and needles coming out of his tiny, emaciated body, my heart is so full of love it actually hurts. When I see him struggle to draw each breath, it's hard to remember how much I didn't want this baby. Now all my energy is focused on willing him to improve. He's not out of danger yet, but he's taken a turn for the better. If everything continues the way it is now, we might be able to bring him home close to his original due date in the first week of September. I know why Liz fell in love with Dr. Jameson. His attitude toward women might be 30 years behind the times, although I suspect much of that's for show. But when it comes to dealing with preemies and their parents, he's a saint. He and Liz are well matched in their intelligence, their sense of humor, their compassion. I've missed meeting the group for breakfast. But I didn't need to show up on Thursdays at 8 to feel their support. I'm not likely to forget everything they've done for me. Their faith and love comforted me during my darkest hours. Soon Peter and I will be making plans to bring Zachary home. I feel more confident than ever that our son will, indeed, be coming home. From the diary of Karen Curtis, September 1st. I barely slept last night. Gwen had her secretary phone me Friday morning to ask for a meeting.
When my agent calls, I'm there. Something inside me said she wanted to discuss my audition for the sitcom, and I was right. The whole time I was driving into L.A., I had this premonition that I'd gotten the role. Any other time in the past 4 years, I would have been so excited, but it wasn't excitement I felt. Instead, I experienced a crazy sort of letdown feeling. Get real. I mean, a television role is what I've wanted my entire life. But by the time I found parking and made my way into Gwen's office building, my stomach was full of knots. That was when it hit me. My head was telling me I should be jumping up and down for joy, and my body was telling me something completely different. It took me a while to connect with my feelings and realize that I didn't want the role. A weekly television show is the opportunity of a lifetime, and worth thousands and thousands of dollars in fees and residuals. I didn't understand what was happening to me or why I'd hesitate. Then again, perhaps I did. The last couple of weeks with the drama class at Willow Grove High School have been fabulous. I love the kids, and I see so much of myself in them. Myself 10 years ago, that is. Creative, talented, passionate, and totally in love with the idea of self-expression. It's more than just teaching that I've enjoyed. Since I've been at the same school as Glenn, we've eaten lunch together every day. I love being around him. Love the way I feel. Or, more accurately, love the way he makes me feel. It's as if I'm the funniest, wittiest, most attractive woman in the world. No man has ever made me feel as special as he does. I remember when we first met, and how Glenn didn't seem passionate enough. Hard to believe I could have been that blind. Well, to make a long story short, when I arrived at Gwen's office, I found out all my worry was for naught. I didn't get the role. In fact, Gwen had viewed the audition tape herself and was disappointed in my performance. She suggested a series of classes for me. In other words, I am no longer meeting her expectations. That was the reason she wanted to meet personally with me. I was being put on notice, so to speak. I didn't sleep well on Friday. And now I'm afraid tonight's going to be an exact repeat. The phone woke Karen out of a deep sleep. It took her a moment to realize the ringing wasn't actually part of her dream. She opened her eyes just enough to glance at her clock radio and saw that it was just past 1 a.m., She hadn't even slept an hour and groaned at having her rest interrupted, especially when she'd had such a hard time falling asleep. "This had better be good," she muttered into the mouthpiece. "Karen?" The timid voice was fragile and breathless.
"Victoria?"
Instantly alert, Karen sat up, blinking rapidly. "Where are you?"
"Home. Can you come and get me and Bryce?"
"Of course. Are you all right?" Victoria didn't answer. Panic filled Karen's throat.
"What happened? Tell me." "I might need you to take me to the hospital."
So this time Roger had gone too far. This time Victoria had had enough. She prayed her sister would press assault charges, prayed she'd leave him for good. "Where's Roger?"
"He's asleep. Just hurry."
Never in her life had Karen dressed faster. She pulled on sweats, then shoved her feet into tennis shoes without bothering to tie them. Not until she was in her car did she wonder why her sister hadn't simply left on her own. There was something Victoria hadn't told her. Coming to a red light, Karen stopped and looked both ways. She didn't see any traffic in either direction. Unwilling to waste time waiting for the traffic signal to proceed through its cycle, she ran the light. Halfway through the intersection, she caught sight of a police car. A heartbeat later, the patrol car was behind her, lights flashing. "Great, just great," she muttered. Then she realized this could be the most opportune event of her life. Karen pulled over to the side of the deserted street. As the officer approached her vehicle, she rolled down her window.
"Good evening," he said politely. "Did you happen to notice that the light at the intersection of Universal and Sixth was red?"
"Officer, listen. My sister just phoned me, and I'm afraid her husband beat her again. She asked that I come and get her. My brother-in-law is physically abusive, and I don't know exactly what the situation is right now."
The young patrol officer asked her a few questions, returned to his vehicle for a moment, and then walked back to her car.
The address you gave me is out of my area. A patrol car has been dispatched and will meet you there.
Thank you. Karen was so grateful she felt like sobbing. Can I leave now? He nodded.
She drove off immediately, careful to stay within the speed limit. She hoped she arrived at her sister's before the police did, so she could explain to Victoria what she'd done and why. It had taken tremendous courage for Victoria to call her, and Karen didn't want to destroy her fragile trust. The outside lights were on when she turned into the driveway. As soon as she did, Victoria opened the door. She held Bryce with her left arm, her right arm cradled against her side. Karen leaped out of the car and hurried forward to help her sister and nephew.
What happened to your arm?
Bryce was sobbing.
Daddy hit me real hard. Then he pulled Mommy's arm.
So Roger had taken to hitting his son. Victoria had accepted the abuse for herself. But now that her husband had begun to hurt their child, she'd drawn the line.
How bad is it?
It doesn't matter. Let's go. Victoria's voice was edged with panic. Karen ushered the two of them toward her car and was fastening Bryce's seatbelt when she heard Roger's shout.
What the hell do you think you're doing, bitch?
Go! Victoria cried.
No! Karen turned to face her brother-in-law, who stood in the open doorway, his hands on his hips. Swearing and clearly drunk, Roger stumbled down the steps and started toward his family. He was in a rage, his face red and twisted with anger. He stared at Karen and then Victoria, who huddled protectively over her son in the back of Karen's vehicle.
You're a pitiful excuse for a man, she said contemptuously.
He swore again and lunged at her. Karen was quick on her feet and managed to avoid his swing. Victoria screamed. Unfortunately, when Karen moved, she gave Roger access to his wife. Cursing, he reached inside the car and yanked on Victoria's arm. Victoria let out a shrill cry of pain. Hardly aware of what she was doing, Karen leaped onto Roger's back, pounding him with both fists. Everyone was shouting at once. Bryce was crying, and Roger was bucking and heaving in an effort to throw Karen off. Out of the corner of her eye, Karen saw a patrol car pull up to the curb and released her frantic hold on her brother-in-law. That gave him the slack he needed to strike out at her. She didn't see the punch coming until it was too late. He got her square in the jaw, hitting with enough force to knock her to the ground. Almost immediately, the two police officers had Roger in a tight grasp. They dragged him away toward their car. Roger's demeanor altered instantly.
Officers, he said, sounding completely sober, I'm glad you're here.
As she listened, Karen couldn't help thinking that her brother-in-law was the one who deserved a career on the stage. According to him, Karen was a meddlesome troublemaker intent on breaking up his marriage. He wanted to press charges against her for a malicious attack on his person. While it was true he'd struck out at her, he said, he'd only been defending himself. He demanded that the police haul her away. For one confused and crazy minute, that seemed about to happen. Then Victoria stepped forward.
I phoned my sister, she said in a small, hesitant voice.
Roger stared at Victoria.
All right, all right. I'll be willing to drop the assault charges against your sister if you'll agree to put this incident behind us.
You've got to be joking, Karen yelled.
Roger ignored her.
I'll admit, I did get upset with my wife earlier, and I probably overreacted.
He turned to the officers, laughing as if it had all been a misunderstanding that had gotten out of hand.
Oh, I'm sorry, sweetheart, Roger said next, looking at Victoria again and sounding eminently reasonable. I really do regret this. There's no need to get the police involved in a family matter, is there? You don't want this, and neither do I.
Victoria bit her lower lip, her eyes cast down. She actually seemed to be considering his words. Finally, she spoke.
I'm sorry, too, she whispered.
Roger relaxed and glanced toward the police officers again.
A man works hard all week. Is it too much to ask that his wife have his dinner ready when he gets back from a Saturday golf game with clients?
I'm sorry,
Victoria repeated, her voice stronger and more confident now.
I know you are, Roger said in cajoling tones.
Why don't we let these people go about their business and get back inside? Come on, sweetheart.
Karen thought she was going to be sick. Victoria turned to face the two police officers.
I'm so sorry it's come to this. I'll be pressing abuse charges against my husband. I believe my shoulder's been dislocated. This isn't the first time he's hit me. Doctor's records will confirm a number of recent visits in which I've been treated for so-called accidents.
Roger's anger exploded, and he started toward his wife, fists clenched. But the police restrained him. Within minutes, he was in handcuffs and in the back of the patrol car. From the diary of Claire Craig, October 22nd. The boys have been taking turns staying with Michael during the days, although it's difficult for them to see their father like this. They both decided to take the first semester off from college. They didn't want to leave their father, knowing that Michael's time is very short now. I'm proud of them. It isn't easy to watch your parent die, and they're handling this with an inner strength I didn't know they possessed. I relieve the boys in the evenings when I get home from the dealership. My long hours of work these past few months have brought the dealership back to prosperity. With the staff's cooperation, I've managed to avert chaos and financial disaster. All of my ideas have been welcomed and put into action. And all the employees have rallied around me. With some inventive, humorous television advertising, the dealership was reaching record sales. I don't spend a lot of time alone with Michael. Because of my hours at work, I often don't arrive home until he is asleep, but he remains in my thoughts and in my heart. It has come as a revelation to discover I still love him. Not the same way I had when we were married, of course. Now I love him because of what we had, what we once were to each other. I love him as the man who fathered my children. Living with my ex-husband isn't easy. Despite that, I feel the decision has been right, for Michael, for me, and for our sons. Who would have thought the end would come like this? I've hated Michael, and I've loved him. Now, as death grows closer, I've discovered that my love is stronger than my hate. Mom, Alex gently tapped her shoulder, and Claire started, unaware she'd fallen asleep. As she'd sat vigil at Michael's bedside, she drifted off. Her sons stood on the other side of the bed, looking at her, their eyes filled with dread and pain.
Dad's breathing is slowed, Mick told her.
Claire chewed on her lower lip. This was exactly what they'd been told would happen. Michael was in the final stages of the disease and had, several days earlier, quietly slipped into a coma. Her pulse racing, Claire reached for Michael's hand, holding it firmly between her own, as his body released its life. This was it? The end? Somehow Claire had expected there to be more as Michael Craig moved serenely from life to death. Then the reality of it suddenly overwhelmed her, and with it came a flood of pain. The current so strong it threatened to pull her under, to consume her. Alex broke down and crumpled into the chair. His shoulders racked with sobs. Mick stood tall and silent. Claire wanted to reach out to both her children, but was lost in her own agony. We will always love you. She choked out the words and leaned down to kiss Michael's forehead. Kiss him goodbye. It's over, Mick announced, as though this was the end, when in some ways it was only the beginning. Claire nodded and walked around to the other side of the bed. Her two sons hugged her, the three of them forming a tight circle. The same circle they'd formed the afternoon Michael had moved out of the family home. Only this time, Michael was gone forever. The funeral took place 2 days later, and the service was crowded with people from the business community, family and friends. Claire hosted the wake at her house. Liz, Karen, and Julia were all there, helping with the setup, seeing to the guests, and lending Claire their love and support. She would never have asked them to help, but was grateful her dearest friends could be with her. It was evening before the last of the relatives and business associates had left. Mick and Alex were in the living room talking with Karen and Julia when Claire sat down in the kitchen. Liz joined her.
It's about time you took a rest.
How are you holding up? Rather than answer, Claire simply nodded.
It hurts, doesn't it?
More than I ever thought it could, Claire whispered.
We were divorced. I assumed I'd done my grieving. I didn't have a clue. When he died, I felt as though someone had shot me in the gut.
Liz nodded.
I remember when the police officer came to tell me Steve was gone. I heard the words, saw his mouth move and understood what he was saying, but I couldn't take it in. I just couldn't absorb it.
Claire tried to speak and couldn't. Then Liz, who seemed to read the agony in her heart, reached across the table and touched her arm. Claire tried to hold back the tears, but it was too hard. She hurt too much.
Go ahead, Liz said softly. You don't have to be strong anymore. Let it go.
Claire broke into sobs and felt the comforting arms of her friend around her. Thursday morning breakfast club. It was barely November, and already Christmas decorations were up. Claire pulled into the strip mall where Mocha Moments was located. Claire entered the coffee shop, waved to Liz, who was already there, and read over the menu, although she always ordered the same thing. When the group had first started gathering, her double-shot espresso, bitter and strong, had matched her mood. It was time for a change.
Espresso and currant scone, right? The young man behind the counter said, obviously proud of his memory.
Normally, yes, but I'm in the mood for something different this morning. I'll have a pecan roll and coffee.
Coming right up.
When her order was ready, Claire joined Liz and followed only a couple of minutes later by Karen. Julia arrived last, with Zachary in his carrier. She set him in the middle of the table. They took turns peeking at the baby. In some ways, this precious little boy belonged to the entire Thursday morning group. Like the other women, Claire had invested a great deal of emotion in Zachary. The infant's successful struggle for life brought balance to the loss she had so recently suffered. She was thrilled to see that he was thriving.
It's almost time for us to come up with another word for the year,
Liz said once they'd all sat down with their orders. For next year, I mean.
Already?
Claire protested.
You're as bad as these mall people putting up Christmas decorations before Thanksgiving.
What are we supposed to do with the word from this year? Karen asked.
What was your word?
With so much on her mind, Claire had forgotten.
Acceptance.
Did you learn anything from it?
This came from Liz.
Karen took a sip of her peppermint-flavored latte and mulled over the question.
Yes, I think I have. A year ago, I was constantly arguing with my mother over which direction I should take. I was so sure I knew what was right for me. She thought I should be a teacher.
Go figure. Karen made a mocking face.
When I chose acceptance, I wanted my mother to accept me for who I am. I wanted her to appreciate me.
She apparently knows you better than you know yourself.
Karen nodded. I never realized how much I'd enjoy a classroom, but I'm loving every minute of it. My mother has her annoying little habits, but then we all do. She only wants what's best for me and for Victoria.
Claire exchanged a look with Liz.
This was Karen speaking? Wow, what a difference in less than a year.
Over the last few months, I've learned that I needed to accept myself first. I wanted Mom to be proud of me the way she was of my sister. At the same time, I resisted that feeling and tried to be as different from Victoria as possible.
I don't know what Victoria would have done without you, Liz said.
Karen dismissed the praise and seemed almost embarrassed by it.
She's my sister.
Get back to your word, Julia urged. I want to know what you learned.
Okay. I thought I wanted to act, to work in theater and film, and I do. But I don't need to look for my self-worth in a credit scrolling down some screen. I've discovered something better.
Teaching high school drama classes? Julia supplied.
Being on stage is great fun, but sharing my love of the stage with others is even more compelling.
That's great! Claire was genuinely pleased for her. What's the latest on your sister? Liz asked. As you already know, Roger's serving a 6-month jail term. Victoria's seeing a counselor, and with the help of my parents and Roger's, she's back in her own home. She loves her job selling commercial real estate and seems to have a real knack for it. Mom and I are both confident that she's going to be just fine.
Good for her, Liz said.
Karen heaved a sigh. There's something else about acceptance. Glenn and I are seriously discussing marriage.
He proposed? Julia cried excitedly.
Well, yes.
And you've accepted,
Claire finished for her. Karen's face beamed with happiness, and she nodded.
He's perfect for me. It's amazing how well we balance each other.
Oh, guys, I'm so in love.
That's the way it's supposed to be, Liz said.
When's the wedding?
May. I already have my new word, bride.
Claire exchanged smiles with Liz. It wouldn't surprise her if next year Liz announced that she was marrying Dr. Jameson.
What was your word again, Liz? Claire asked.
Time. Last January, I hit a real low point in my life. Claire remembered how lost Liz had been without her family around her. It seemed as if all the good years had somehow slipped through my fingers. I felt as though time was disappearing and taking with it everything I'd wanted to accomplish and never would. She frowned. I suppose I was afraid of living the rest of my life alone. It was bad enough when I lost Steve, but then without the children around me, the loneliness seemed so much worse.
Do you still feel lonely? Julia asked.
Liz looked thoughtful.
No. Time is still a good word for me, but not for the reasons I assumed. This is my time. In the last 12 months, I've learned to relax and enjoy every single minute.
You forgot to mention that it's also your time to fall in love.
Liz smiled. Falling in love. I feel like I'm in high school again.
Silly, isn't it?
No, Julia insisted with a wistful sigh of her own. I think it's wonderful.
What about you, Claire? Liz asked.
What was your word for the year?
Faithful. I chose it in anger on New Year's Day. At the time, I was trapped in bitterness. I remember thinking I was the one who'd always been faithful to Michael, to our family, and to myself.
You were faithful right to the very end. Julia's voice was so quiet the others had to strain to hear.
Yes, but not in the way I'd anticipated.
I can't tell you how much I admire what you did for Michael, Liz told her.
Claire looked away, embarrassed by the praise. A year ago, she would have laughed in the face of anyone who dared to suggest she'd bring Michael back into the family home. Yet she had. She'd nursed him, loved him, and together with her sons, she'd buried him.
I did learn a valuable lesson this year.
What was that? Liz asked.
I hated Michael for what he'd done to me and the boys. I mean, I really hated him. I didn't dare let any of you know how intense my anger with him was, for fear you'd think I should be locked away.
Her friends silently studied her, and Claire had the feeling that her confession hadn't come as any big shock. They knew and had always known, and I loved him. Deeply and totally, despite everything. In the end, I forgave him, and I forgave myself. In ways I thought were impossible, I was faithful to both of us, to what we'd been, and to the people we really were.
Flustered, she waved her hand and looked away. I'm not expressing myself very well.
Liz reached for her hand and squeezed it.
Yes, you are. You're making perfect sense.
Claire laughed, the sound deep and throaty, and the noise startled Zachary awake. Julia deftly dealt with her son, bringing him into her arms.
I had an epiphany of my own this last year. My word was gratitude, but it should have been surprise.
I remember the day you told us you were pregnant, Karen said, grinning down at Zachary, who looked back at her with big, beautiful blue eyes.
Our family's working as a team now, Julia said. I'm amazed at Adam and Zoe and how unselfish they've become for Zach.
What an incredible blessing he's been.
Starting over with another child is a challenge. I'll grant you that. But I wouldn't change a thing.
You said you had an epiphany.
Basically, that's it. I realize that I can have it all. The big, beautiful home, the husband and family, plus the career. Just not at the same time. I will return to my shop, but not until it's right for Zach.
That's so wise, Karen said, as though in awe.
Claire smiled. You'd be surprised how smart we all are, you included. So here they were, the four of them, each at a different place in her life. They could laugh together and cry together, and often did. Sometimes both at once. To everything there is a season, and these were the seasons of their lives. Four women, all friends, who met every Thursday morning at 8. Thank you for choosing a DH Audio production. Look for other DH Audio programs at your local retailer or visit our website at www.dhaudio.com.